And we'll start right off with the agenda. Ms. Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sue Wilson. I'm administrator of the Human Resource Services Division in the Department of Administrative Services. And you have a copy, I believe, of the presentation that we're going to be showing on PowerPoint up here for you if you have some questions along the way. I know we have some limited time. But what I want to walk through is some of the basics of the state personnel system, particularly as it may relate to things that you're going to be hearing in front of you in Ways and Means. And I sort of feel like I need a swivel chair and see what's going on. Basically, the personnel system of state government is to deal with the people part of the work that we do. And all of these are elements of the things that we will be doing in relation to human resources, compensation, trying to attract a skilled and diverse workforce, managing performance, training and development. We do bargain labor contracts and manage those union relationships, and then maintain all the information about state employees. A little bit of information about the state government workforce. As of December 31st, 2006, we had in the executive branch 32,089. Now, these are number of employees, people that we have on the payroll as of that time. How that compares with 2 years prior, December 31st of 2004, statewide we were up 202 people. In the executive branch, we were up 23. Just kind of gives you an idea of how those numbers have flowed over the past 2 years. As of December 31st, 2006, a breakdown of those employees a little bit more. We had in management supervisory employees 3,545, management non-supervisory 1,103, and non-management 27,441. The distinction there is our statutory definition of management service includes some people who are not supervising employees, but by virtue of the work that they are doing, they can't be in a type of position that could potentially be represented. So these are confidential employees, employees that have access to information that may be used in bargaining and are therefore considered to be in management service but are not truly supervising employees. Oops. Our workforce is becoming more diverse. That's clearly a goal that we have. We do have a statewide performance measure that calls for the state government's workforce to reflect the racial and ethnic diversity of the state's labor force. We would like that to be a direct match, 100%. We are currently up from 69% in 2004 to 73% in 2005. Basically, the state workforce itself, the Oregon workforce, is about 16% ethnic diversity. The state of Oregon's workforce is about 12%. And we'll go through some of the specifics on things that we're doing to try to increase that number and get it to 100%.
Madam Chair? Supervisor Gordon, thank you. Would you like questions now or later? I have a burning question on this topic.
I'll let a burning question go, but generally I think we ought to let the presenters finish their testimony.
I appreciate Senator. That. Ms. Wilson, I just want to give you a heads up that I am deeply disappointed in the recent hiring process for the administrator, for the advocacy commissions. That process has been mismanaged from the start. We're on round two. In the meantime, the advocacy commissions go without an administrator, without support. This is a situation that has gone on now for well over a year, and I'm looking for correction. And again, I want to make it very, very clear from where I'm sitting this morning that there needs to be some improvement. And I'm going to use a word that I have not used very often in this process. We're looking at incompetence in the way in which this process has been managed.
Something has to change. And her comments on this issue.
Thank you.
Ms. Wilson. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Gourley, I do hear your concerns. Relating to labor relations in state government, we have 31 negotiated labor contracts. That covers about 28,000 state employees. We have 10 different unions with whom we have contracts, and we are currently, we do biennial contracts, two-year contracts. We are currently in the process of starting negotiations with those unions now. Basically, how we manage personnel within state government is established through law and rules, through Oregon Revised Statutes, administrative rules. We fall under federal regulations in a number of cases. We also have our collective bargaining agreements, which in some cases trump even state law, and legal decisions that, again, send us to the policy direction that we head. ORS Chapter 240 and 243 identify the personnel systems as part of state government, and we are responsible for the central administration of those. Now, a few of the things that may be of interest specifically to the Ways and Means Committee, I know, is often classification and compensation. So I want to give you just some brief information related to that. Classification is the groupings and how we group jobs together. First, we have a job description, a position description, which says what it is that that job does, what are the skills that are needed for the job, and then we take those across state government, group them accordingly to like work, and come up with classifications. Compensation is then evaluated based on where that classification is, and we use a matrix that assigns value to the different work that is done, and then puts job duties in a hierarchy of state relationships, and we do market studies to then assign relationship to that. There are currently 675 classes of jobs in state government. That number is actually down from what it has been in the past. At the direction of the legislature, we have been moving to broader classifications of positions. We do have an ongoing process to try and keep our classifications up to date. An ideal turnaround would be probably every 5 to 7 years. In reality, we're probably closer to 10 to 12. This is unfortunately not uncommon in state governments. When we check across the country, we find that a lot of states are 12 to 15 years out in trying to keep up with classifications. Some of our classes that we have now really haven't been updated since about 1990, and we are putting schedules together to try to update those. Just again, to give you an idea, I think often when people speak of state employees, there seems to be a particular type of job in mind, and I want to remind people that with the 675 classifications, we have a very broad range of jobs in state government, some that are completely unique to state government. As you can see here, we have, yes, we have financial and accounting and administrative people. We also have communicable disease inspectors. We have boiler inspectors. We have correctional officers, all of which may be somewhat unique to government as job classifications. The merit system, which is established by statute, says how we should go about determining pay for state employees related to both individual performance, prevailing rates of pay for the services performed, and looking at market obligations that are established by collective bargaining agreements, and finally, the state's financial condition. The state's ability to pay is an area that we look at in terms of compensation. We did a major review of the compensation system in 1985 with comparable worth, realigning state jobs, and we still use that same criteria now to determine our matrix and take a look and see where compensation levels are. It's also something that we can do what are called selectives, selective salary increases. If we find that a particular classification is way off the market, things may have changed, we will go in, take a look at the classification, and redo the analysis and look at market. And we are finding ourselves doing some of that these days. Most of that is driven by bargaining, and bargaining does determine the salary levels, and so we will have assignment of salaries that can be a result of bargaining also. Most of the classifications, when you come into a state position, you're in a salary range, and the position will have 8, 9, or now 10 salary steps assigned to it, which generally means once a year you move up one step. Each step represents an average increase of about 4.75. And in the recent statistics that we ran, we found that the vast majority of the people who have been hired in the last fiscal year were brought in at the first or second step. So 76% of the people who came in the last fiscal year were hired either at step one or step two. Those being hired at the top of those steps, we had about 4% hired near the top steps. That generally is when we have a situation where we have a highly skilled situation. We're trying to attract someone in. We find someone whose salary most likely may be higher than state government, and we bring them in near the top so that we can try to maintain where they are. But that number is relatively small at this point in time. Some of the classifications, as I said, are unique to state government, and these are some of the challenges that we have in the area of compensation. Most managers are in the classification of is called principal executive manager. Starts at A and goes through J. It's a very broad-based management classification, and it's very difficult to go to even other public sector or private sector and find matches for those, because we will have managers who are managing things such as the Department of Human Services, other managers who are managing smaller level programs, and it's difficult to find the matches for them in compensation. This is a challenge that we have that we're trying to begin to examine how we can look at those market comparabilities for state managers. The state is viewed as one employer, and what we sometimes hear is, this is rigid, we have problems in an agency and we want to be able to do what we need to do to get people on. We have the responsibility to maintain balance overall, and our goal is fair and equitable treatment of all employees. So we are continually pulling back people to the state as one employer, and therefore actions that are taken, particularly in relation to classification and compensation, they cross agency lines, and we try to maintain those at a state level rather than responding specifically to agencies. Very quickly, you can see on the chart again how you create new positions through the budget process. The agency determines that there's a body of work, generally is going to be associated with a policy option package that they bring in front of you in the budget. They develop the policy package, submit that to budget and management. We take a look at that to see if the classifications that an agency asked for are appropriate, and we often work with agencies to get those to appropriate levels. The legislature reviews that budget package and passes the package. The position is then established in our position inventory control system, PICS, and it's released to us to put into our personnel position database, and the agency then can have access and begin to recruit and fill that position. Then going to the hiring process, the employee is hired, and we work through the general employment cycle that we have. There are other ways for people to come into state government. Non-permanent positions. Temporary hires are something that the statute allows for. But an individual can be hired only for a period of 1,040 hours in any 12-month period of time. So that equates to about 6 months. So, and again, this is state as one employer. So a person can't come in as a temp for one agency, finish their 1,040, and go to another agency immediately. This is for emergency non-recurring work. The other way that positions can come in is through the limited duration position approach. A position can be created by the legislature as part of your budget process that is limited duration, which says this is only for the upcoming biennium, and at the end of the biennium, that goes away. I did a very quick run. Our data, unfortunately, is not explicit enough in the systems that we have to be able to tell you which of the LD positions have been established by the legislature and which are limited duration positions which an agency has established administratively. That is something that can be done during the biennium, where an agency has a body of work that they know is going to last longer than that six-month period of time. They can create a limited duration position that, again, goes away at the end of the biennium and use that for a particular project. It looks like in the last year we've had about 700 limited duration positions. About 500 of those, it appears, were established by the legislature, and I can only tell that by the dates of establishment. We don't have as good a data on that as I would like. Agencies have to find the funding for the positions in those cases for that period of time, and then the positions, again, would go away. The other thing that you often hear about are reclassifications. And what happens with a reclassification is the work in a position changes significantly. And there are business reasons, new projects, work changes that may drive them to make those particular changes. This requires a change of the work assignment and therefore the classification so that the employee is appropriately classified and appropriately compensated for the work that they're doing. For changes to a complete group of positions, let's say something happens and we feel that a particular group of biologists, their work has changed dramatically, we will do a classification study statewide, and we will look at all of those, and we may propose a change in the classification statewide for a class. What can also happen, though, is an individual job may be reviewed, and actually the employee can ask for this kind of review to be done if they feel that the work they have done has changed. That then goes through an administrative process to determine if the work actually is in a different classification. And if it is, then the agency is responsible for developing a plan to be able to do that reclassification using the position authority that the legislature gave to that agency. So the legislature establishes what we call permanent financing, which is all the position authority that you have given to an agency. An administrative reclass requires that that agency take something away from something else if this particular position is going to go up. So they have to manage within the elements of that permanent financing that the legislature has given to the agency. Administrative reclasses are reviewed by budget management for that finance plan, and they're reviewed by Human Resource Services Division to make sure that it is appropriate that that classification be changed. Just a little bit in workforce trends in general. The state is seeing some of the same trends that the private sector is seeing. We do have the potential for significant retirements from the state. We believe that about 20% of our current workforce will be eligible to retire within the next 3 years, and that increases between 35 and 40% over the next 10 years. If you look at particular positions, those percentages are much higher when you get into higher level management, that we will see a higher percentage of our higher level management eligible for retirement in the next 3 to 5 years. We're also seeing some turnover in some professional areas. And this, again, also mirrors not just the state of Oregon, but internationally. Anything in the medical field is currently very difficult for the state to recruit. Some skilled professional areas, such as finance and accounting, we are beginning to see, not even beginning to see, we are now in the throes of having difficulty in recruiting those particular individuals to state government. In general, the state's turnover rate isn't unusually high. We fall in the 5 to 10% range of general turnover, which is, again, not unusual. When we get into some of these specialty categories, we're now beginning to see 15 to 20% turnover. And that becomes troubling as we try to maintain the program areas that we're dealing with. We are trying to institute some new recruitment approaches. Working more with colleges and universities to make the state more of a viable option. We are in the process of a statewide recruitment improvement project, which actually has us using the employment department's tool, iMatch Skills, which they have rolled out for the private sector, and we are working with them to make that work for state government, which basically means this is an online application, an online screening, and it puts it's a skill match base, which allows people to go into a database. When they match, they are sent notice of the job. Now, a lot of people in the state don't necessarily think of state government as their first employer of choice. What we want to do is get those state positions in front of people who might not have thought previously about a state job. So this expands our ability to get out to a different labor market. We have also found for diverse labor forces that the online screening is much more attractive to many people, and particularly the younger folks that we're trying to attract into state government. They want to do it online. They do not want to fill out a paper form. They want to be able to go in and have all of that happen electronically. So that, again, would expand the labor market that we're able to get to. We are also have instituted, with the assistance of the Governor's Affirmative Action Office, a statewide exit interview process, where we now have an online exit interview that we are asking people to fill out to give us some idea of why are people leaving. And we often hear the most common anecdotal reason is compensation. But when we actually look at the data, that so far hasn't necessarily proven to be true. It may be opportunity. Elsewhere, it may be flexibility of scheduling that people want that may or may not be available at the state. So we are just starting to get our data in on exit interviews, and we're going to be using that to try and help form where we go in our recruitment. I would be happy to try and answer any questions. Senator Schrader?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you also explain for the Ways and Means members what a double fill position is and vacancies and why they would occur?
Madam Chair, Senator Schrader, vacancies obviously happen periodically just as part of the natural turnover that happens within state government. What can happen with a double fill position is a situation where an agency, again, may have a special need for a particular project, for a particular situation, and they may leave a position vacant, a particular classification, and if they have a position that's another classification that's more appropriate, put two people into that particular position so that they are at the appropriate classification, most often leaving another one vacant. Again, this all has to be managed within the financial resource available to an agency. I don't have a run right now on the number of double fills, but that's certainly information we can get for you.
Just to follow up, if I may, for the subcommittee members and the chairs in particular, one of the things that we always look at is the number of vacancies in an agency, and as Ms. Wilson points out, they occur in the natural course of events. Sometimes they're there for long periods of time, and the question is it because it's difficult to hire some of the positions she pointed out, or is it because sometimes an agency thinks they need flexibility in the budget, and that the dollars, the positions created, if you have a position, you have money, and that's an opportunity for them to have money that is not necessarily well accounted for or directed, if you will, in the budget. I think I'm saying that hopefully PC, but we want to be mindful of that, and we would ask the subcommittees to look very closely. Governor's budget is somewhat generous in numbers of new FTE. I think when you see your LFO analysis today, the LFO office is somewhat concerned about that. We've done a pretty good job in maintaining our employment base, if you will, in the state of Oregon. And I think back in 2003-2005, we actually, except for OUS, the system hires, we actually reduced our FTE a little bit. So the point is there's a huge increase. We want to watch that. We expect everyone to programs equal people. So on the other side of the equation, you can't have a program sometimes without new people. So we're not trying to cinch it down, but we want you all to look very thoughtfully at that, please.
Okay.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you very much. A comment and a question. I just thought it was interesting, if I heard you correctly in your presentation, that a couple of the most controversial areas with respect to tracking personnel classifications, you're unable to track data on. For limited duration, which are legislatively created and which are agency created, ever since I've been here, that has been a subject of discussion. It just surprises me that you can't track that. It also surprised me when you just said you can't track the number of double fills. That's, you can?
Yes.
She said she just didn't have that one with her.
Oh, I apologize. Okay. The thing that I'm curious about is the number of reclassifications that occurred over the interim and were agency-initiated. There was a time prior to my arrival here when the legislature, I believe, and I would turn to Senator Carter or people who have been here for long periods of time, when the legislature actually acted on all of, or a great number of personnel matters. I know from the time that I ran a state agency that reclassifications occur regularly, and I think it would be extraordinarily helpful if you could provide us with some data on interim reclassifications that were agency initiated before any of us get into our subcommittee work. And I don't know if that's possible.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, yes, we can. What we try to break down, I have some numbers related to reclass, but I will break them down, get some more information for you. On those that that were agency-initiated, most are agency-initiated. We do have some, obviously, that are part of our class studies. Those are more reallocations and reclasses. But the number that I have from the last fiscal year is that there were 814 positions that were reclassed.
I guess one follow-up, Madam Chair.
Senator.
To the degree that at the subcommittee level we can know about these agency-initiated actions and how many positions, for example, in the nomenclature of the agencies, burning a position to create other positions, I think that reclassification, the use of positions has been an area kind of shrouded in mystery, and I hope that I don't speak only for myself in saying that it's something that those of us at the subcommittee level have a keen interest in and would appreciate a greater depth of information before we begin our subcommittee deliberations on those kinds of agency-initiated activities.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, if I could, we want to get as much data as we can. Part of the struggle that we have, and which will be in our budget package, is that our data system was created basically as a filing cabinet. It was a place to put information but not to get anything out of. We struggle with that tremendously and are trying to update that so that you can have, we can have, the management information we need to be able to manage appropriately.
I've got a couple of people in the queue, but just to follow up on this particular point, Ms. Wilson, I hope you've been advised, and if you haven't, I'm sorry for the delay in the communication. The co-chair and I have specifically called this issue out for the subcommittees, that administratively created positions or administratively reclassed positions, we will be expecting those to be permanently financed by the agency with efficiency or improvement savings, not with additional funds. Senator Carter.
Thank you. Good morning, Ms. Wilson. Can you tell me what is the status of lawsuits that are brought on by employees based upon discrimination, number one, at this point? Because I know last session we had about $11 million in extended costs. And number two, what is your strategy for helping management deal with issues of discrimination for those who win their suits as well as those who lose their suits?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, that is obviously something that is of concern to us. And again, this is not unique to state government, but for all businesses across the country, the largest area of increase in terms of tort claims and liability is in the area of employment. And we are tracking those. I have some data that we are in the process of updating right now. I'll tell you that we are not seeing an increase. We have remained fairly constant, fairly flat in the number of employment-related claims that we've had. There are different strategies that are being discussed in terms of how we handle those. We have had a couple of jury decisions that have increased the cost to the state. That's over about the last 3 or 4 years. I will be happy to get some of that information to you. What we are doing, though, is we work very closely both with our risk management division and with the Department of Justice. When we see a case, even before it goes potentially to trial or before it is worked, we know the elements that are involved in that and what has happened, what kinds of situations have occurred. We work with the Department of Justice to get to managers and to HR managers in the state. Here's what happened. Here's what kind of training we need to do. We will incorporate those types of things into the management training that we provide to state government and try to be able to respond to those. I think everyone is aware that employment claims are something that we all want to be careful of. And the number one thing we're seeing right now is retaliation. And so that is an area where we are specifically working on our management training to try to address.
Paula. Senator. I have to tell you, Ms. Wilson, I've been here for 22 years. And I want you to know Department of Human Services has a bad record in terms of helping managers to deal with the issue of discrimination. I have talked to many Hispanics and African Americans who have talked to me and said they don't want to work for the state because it is so encrusted in the department, at the different departments that they have gone to work in, and people have been very hurt, very bad. And I want you to personally know that I'm going to take an interest in this year, and that I'm going to be watching you guys and what you're doing, because I think that you can do a better job. And I don't care how unique it is to other businesses across the state of Oregon has a bad record.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, we welcome your involvement in helping us.
I've got Representative Nathanson, Senator Devlin, Senator Gordley, and Representative Crummell on the list, and now Senator Morris. I do want to make sure that the members in the audience know that they're welcome to ask questions. This is really important for every member of a subcommittee to understand, so let's make sure we understand it as well as possible. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question about workforce trends. There are two important items that you brought up under workforce trends. One is the potential for significant retirements, and the other is higher turnover. I'm concerned about both of those. For example, higher turnover, this is the flip side of the productivity issue. When turnover increases, then you see often a lack of continuity. It can lead to inefficiency and then ultimately reduce our ability, that agency's ability to deliver the service that the public expects. So I'm concerned about turnover. I'm also concerned about the potential for significant retirements. On the one hand, I'm concerned there could be a recruitment problem. You mentioned what I infer is a problem with competitive salaries. We may not be offering the kinds of jobs or circumstances that the incoming workforce is interested in. But the other thing, though, that I'm also interested in hearing about is, do the agencies do anything like a 6 to 8 year forecast so they anticipate the retirements, and I'm assuming that these retirements are going out at the highest level of salary, you know, at the top of the step. You mentioned that the vast majority of people are hired at step one or step two. That should have an impact on the overall cost paid out. So do we do those kinds of 6 or 8 year forecasts?
Madam Chair, Representative Nathanson, we do have the data that goes out. Again, here's where we need to be a little bit careful. We can look at our data and say, here's how it looks like in terms of potential eligibility for retirement. When an individual chooses to retire, we really don't have control of, nor can we ask, when are you going to retire? However, we do have data, and agencies do have data showing all their positions and where they are potentially going to run into some issues. Those again are data things that we are working on, so agencies have that to work with. In terms of the other turnover, yes, there are areas where there is concern about productivity and about skills. We are looking to the workforce that is coming in behind the retirees, and we don't have good information on what their skill level is necessarily. And again, this is not unique to the state of Oregon. This is something that the entire country is experiencing. So we have to look at how we can build skills for those new people coming in.
One short follow-up. Responding to some issues that senators have raised before I spoke, I'm interested not in addition to who's being recruited, why people are leaving, and looking at the diversity issue from both those angles. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Wilson, I don't want to date myself, but I attended some of the comparable worth hearings in the 1980s for the Hays system. One of the things I've always wondered about when we've had these presentations is why we've never done a broad compensation and classification study since then. Because my experience in local government has been that it's done considerably more often than we have done it. And can you give us some comparables for, like, Western states for how often they have done them? Because 21 years seems like quite a while. And I'm not trying to compare, you know, as we sort of reclassify positions, that, like, we're building data systems like we built them in the state piece by piece and never went back and really realigned everything. But it does seem to me odd that that it's been 21 years and we've never taken another broad look at the compensation and classification system in the state.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I'll be happy to get you some Western states information. And just, you know, again, one of the reasons I think that we haven't done a real broad-based look is simply a matter of resource.
Okay. Senator Gordley?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Ms. Wilson and colleagues, for a more complete understanding of the state personnel system, and that's our focus, the state personnel system, and how it is performing, and I place the emphasis on performing with regard to where and how the workforce is becoming more diverse. We would need a presentation from the Governor's Office of Affirmative Action that would allow us to get into detail and gain a much deeper understanding of where are the challenges, the barriers, opportunities, again related to the workforce becoming more diverse. And it's my recommendation that that the co-chairs schedule the Governor's Affirmative Action Director to present information to the full committee on how these agencies are actually performing, so that we have the big picture and that we look at the performance of DAS more deeply. And then with that information, we can have a much better understanding of where we are in compliance with an Oregon statute that says that Oregon shall be a leader in attaining equal employment opportunities and also in affirmative action. This, frankly, has been a very challenging issue in my time of service, which is going on 16 years. We have not been aggressive in the way in which we've looked at these issues. Our approaches have been fragmented. The commitment, frankly, just has not been there. Now we have an opportunity to do it differently. And I hope that we will. We need to. That needs to be our commitment. And so that's my recommendation.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Crummell, would you mind coming up to the mic so that we can catch your question and comments on tape?
Which mic, ma'am?
Take your pick, sir. It's fine with me.
Sorry.
These are the camps. So. Thank you, Madam Chair. The question that I have is kind of in a follow-up to a question that Co-Chair Schrader had relative to the positions and double fills and that sort of thing. Right now, the law stipulates that agencies that have positions that have been vacant for longer than 6 months will make a report to DAS, and then DAS will, depending on what the agency says, why the position was not filled or has been left vacant, then reports to the emergency board during the interim and to the legislature during session. With a recommendation as to whether or not the position should be unscheduled and the money put basically back into the pot, or whether it should be left for the agency to go ahead and continue keeping that as an open position. Can you tell us, first of all, are the agencies reporting to you as they're required to? Are you then preparing that report for the e-board or for the legislature? And can you tell us how many positions through, because of that statute being passed, and I believe it was in 01, how many are unscheduled now because of that process? What kind of savings have we actually seen in that?
Madam Chair, Representative Cronell, I wish that I could. That report is made to the Budget Management Division. They don't let me near the money. So I can work with Budget Management and find out that information for you. But it's because the unscheduling has to be done through the Budget Management Division. Human Resources is not involved.
Madam Chair, if I may, just as a comment, I believe that that there's not ever been a report made to the e-board. Several e-board members that I have talked to, the director of DAS that I've talked to about this issue, there's, to his knowledge, never been a report made. First, it was the excuse that we were in a recession, and gee, we just had too many things to do getting ready for all of these special sessions we had in 02, and then there was some other excuse. Quite frankly, with regards to this, for us in terms of budgeting and how we look at these budgets and how we look at the agency personnel requests, Madam Chair, I'm tired of the excuses. I want to see the reports.
Thank you, Representative. Ms. Wilson will work with you and the other folks at DAS to get that information. Thank you. Senator Morse?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. My question has to do with the step increases. And can you give us an idea of how often step increases are applied?
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, generally these step increases are considered merit increases on a date, annual date, where an employee is given an evaluation and eligible then for that merit step increase. And those generally occur once a year.
A follow-up.
Senator?
Thank you. It seems that we have the potential, if not actual, systemic problem, because what we have are rates of increase based on steps of 4.75% annually, plus COLAs, plus negotiated benefits, and those, the sum of which, when added up, are they sustainable over time, given the total cost of employment in our state? And I raise that issue as one that I'm not sure that the revenue curve can keep up with the expense curve.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, just a clarification. The way the state system is set up, when we look at comparable salaries, say in the private sector, what we do is look at our top step and compare that to the average of that same classification in a different. So the assumption is that we are bringing in people below market rate, who are allowing them to gain experience and move up that step, rather than hiring them at the top step, which is the average of the market.
Thank you. There's more discussion on this that we can occur.
There is more discussion, and I'm going to briefly jump in the queue here because
I would like, when you are coming back to us with a review of other states in terms of the frequency of their comprehensive reviews, I would like to know what the average state step, the average step increase that other Western states use as well, as part of that information. Thanks for raising it, Senator. Representative Boone, would you like to find a mic and ask a question?
I'll sit next to Sue, if that's okay.
Yeah, don't move your cup. That's okay.
Mine is probably more of a comment on what I've been hearing, and I won't get into the specifics because it fits in with what you're talking about. And that is my concern that we make sure that our management teams are trained in personal approaches to their employees underneath them, and have them all buy into our mission, which is what we're talking about, funding our programs. And if it's my sense that if our and we're the, those are the frontline workers, people who deliver the services, and that's our reputation, and those are the people we hear from when things go wrong for our constituents. So if you can manage a way that you build trust and loyalty within your team and have your people who work with you, your whole team, buy into the mission of the state's program that they're delivering, they will be, you know, they will be loyal to each other, and they will be loyal to our state, which then is loyal to our people that we're delivering these services to. And there will be less emphasis and grumbling underneath about the compensation levels, which are lower in some cases. But I think that if people feel good about their job and what they're doing and the quality of the service they're delivering, we'll hear about it that way, and it will more closely match, I think, what we're trying to get to at this point. And then one last thing on that, and one way that we can help do that, and I don't know exactly how, but I have some ideas for later discussion, is to match the service providers to the population. And that is, for example, if you're talking about natural resources, choose people who understand that issue and understand the people who live with those issues and what you're trying to do in delivering the service or providing the regulation to them in as user-friendly a way as possible, listening to them and letting them understand why we're doing this. I mean, that's a lot easier going on the public than a top-down approach. You must, you will, you shall. And I think that works with the, for example, Department of Human Services too, is if we have a more user-friendly and personally friendly workforce, that we will hear less complaints about those overcompensated state workers who just slack off all the time and don't do their jobs. And we'll hear that people are really doing their job and doing it good, doing it well, excuse me.
So. Thank you, Representative. I have one last question, and then I am going to wrap this one up because we have other presenters. Senator Berger.
Thank you very much, Madam Co-Chair. This question may be for you or for one of the co-chairs, but following up what Representative Krumel said, it's been my understanding that when a budget is approved and it includes those unfilled positions, that that money can actually be used for other purposes, such as benefits, and has been used as such. Is that incorrect or correct?
I don't know the answer to that, but I don't know about benefits. It can be used for other purposes. I don't know if benefits. Ms. Wilson, could you give some
data? Madam Chair, Senator Schrader, I think I would defer to some of the budget folks specifically on that.
We'll get you that answer,
but let's do understand that when the legislature approves budgets, we approve appropriations to the agencies, and we hire professionals to deliver the services that we expect those agencies to deliver. So we give them a fair amount of flexibility. Exactly how much, we'll get a more specific answer for you. Okay, one last question, Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Chair Nolan. Ms. Wilson, to follow up on Senator Morse's line of questioning, your literature here shows that ORS 24235 requires that the merit pay system should take into account first individual performance and accomplishment. I believe in your statement on step raises, you indicated that was primarily a seniority-driven function where the merit pay, the steps came in the form of annual merit pay increases. I wondered, how does the performance and accomplishment, how is that weighted into whether someone will or will not receive a step increase?
Madam Chair, Senator Winsett, that is technically a part of the system, that there are evaluations that are to be performed, and that is to be part of the merit step. I will say that it is unusual for someone not to receive their annual merit step.
Thank you, Ms. Wilson. Appreciate it. Now, colleagues, we are going to start on actual overviews of the budget itself. We'll start with the Deputy Legislative Fiscal Officer, Teresa McHugh, and a statewide perspective. Ms. McHugh.
Okay, now, as I'm getting this on here, let me see, for the record, Teresa McHugh, Legislative Fiscal Office. Let me see if I can maybe help answer the last question a little bit in terms of... the question about what happens in the committee relative to vacant positions that are left in the budget. It does depend on what direction the subcommittee sends and in the budget report. In some cases, the subcommittee has left that there as flexible funding in effect for the agency. In other cases, they have requested the unscheduling of those funds by the Department of Administrative Services. If the Department of Administrative Services unschedules those funds, they are unavailable to the agency to be used for expenditure. So hopefully that helps a little bit.
That helps a bit. Thanks.
Very quickly, we'll try and see if we can get you back on schedule a little. I will start with saying we can, especially with your staff today, as you have all of us come forward to try and keep you somewhat on schedule. Just remember you can always contact us to have follow-up questions as well. And a lot of what you're going to see in the statewide overview, you will receive before you leave. Our documents are going to be given to you, and you have two. The big book.
Homework assignments, colleagues, homework.
This is the agency-by-agency analysis of the governor's recommended budget. And then there's a summary document, which looks very large for a summary document. About half of it, though, are, again, tables. And, again, if you you do have a summary of overall information as well in the front. So I encourage you to look at those. So to get started, this is just to give you a little bit of a grounding before you get into each of the program areas today to look a little bit on where is the state overall. And again, the first chart just provides you some historical data on the total funds budget as well as the four major components, general fund, lottery funds, other funds, and federal funds. And if you look at that, you can see that we have had significant growth. And in fact, even during the recession, the total funds budget has never gone down in the state of Oregon since, I haven't gone back before 77, 79, but in that period of time. If you look at components within that budget, you will see, for example, if you look into the 0103, the bottom component, which is general fund, is reduced. However, there are more other funds and federal funds that, in effect, made the total funds budget still grow. In terms of the slowest growth in total funds, that actually was back in the early 80s, and 81, 83 was the slowest growth in total funds, as you can see there. So, again, huge growth about your other funds. Significant growth. We're known as another fund state, and it's grown about five times its original cost in 77, 79 in that 30 years. But actually, some of the just fund has grown a little bit faster than that.
Madam Co-Chair.
Senator Wesson.
Teresa, I think that's a very indicative slide, but in terms of true purchasing power, could you direct us to where we could find that representation adjusted for to inflation from a given specific $1957 dollars or some other benchmark?
Madam Chair, Senator Westland, that is one of the things that hopefully as we get into subcommittees we can provide a little more data to you on specific areas of adjusting them for population inflation. But you are correct. These are just total dollars, and certainly you would, if you adjust for population inflation and frankly other drivers of the budget, such as mandated caseloads in areas where perhaps initiatives have passed or something of that nature, you would then see this to be a much flatter picture. Okay, wrong direction. This just gives you, again, all of these charts I always caution, because what charts do is give you an overall picture, and then it really leads to what are the questions and what are the drivers. What you see here is the four major program areas in the general fund lottery funds. Education split into actually K-12 and other education, human services, public safety, and then an all other category. And it shows it back to 9901 in terms of how much the total general fund lottery fund was this particular area, what was its percentage or share. And certainly what you see here is that K-12 has come down, while some others have either been stable or peaked a little. One of the issues then drives you to what have been the drivers for why that's happened. And again, we'll talk a little bit more. You will talk a lot more in your subcommittees about those drivers. In public safety, certainly ballot measure 11. Prison construction has been a primary driver, and we're watching that area grow at about 20% a biennium. And again, dealing with, in effect, those mandates. So what happens is it drives other areas of the budget. The all other category, if you see that, there's a couple things that skew that a little. First of all, it's small in general, but a couple things skew that a little bit in terms of this, so I'll point them out. Is remembering natural resources now has a dedicated funding source. They're in that all other in terms of lottery funds. So a lot of your lottery is no longer really discretionary. It is mandated. And the other thing is that, as we look especially in the GRB, your salary dollars for state employees are always stuck into that all other in the governor's rec budget, in the legislatively adopted budget. Then they are distributed out during the emergency board. So we've got some fine-tuning to do with some of these charts as well to make them truly comparison-based in those respects. We're not going to go through the numbers, but you have this available for you. But it's just to talk about how the budget's developed and what tools are available for you as you look at budgets. Certainly in a budgeting capacity, we go back to the last budget that this body passed, and then we say, what would it cost to continue what the last body passed? There is no entitlement to anything in the budget, per se. The legislature could go back and change fundamental things, but we do try to give you a context of, if you continued everything the way it's been done, what would it cost? And that's the essential budget. And so this gives you a percentage increase, tells you what's happened there, and you'll notice a couple negatives on there. That's because you do often send directions of dollars that are one-time in nature and say, we don't want those again, and so those get pulled out. Then you have a governor's recommended budget, and you can see the percentage changes there as well.
So I really would like to hold questions till Ms. McHugh is done, please.
So 709 essential budget, total funds, $45 billion. And you can see the distribution. About half of our dollars come from other funds. Other funds are dedicated resources for a specific purpose. An other fund might be tuition in the higher education system, might be a licensing fee you pay, but they are dedicated resources. General fund, your one fungible fund type. Federal funds usually connect to another dollar. In many cases, a lot of the federal funds, most, are in the Department of Human Services, and they are match dollars. In other words, you take the general fund dollar away from human services, that federal dollar, two federal dollars usually will go away as well. Lottery funds, about 2% of the budget are important, but as people talk about the lottery being kind of, if you will, the savior of the budget, it's still a fairly small percentage of the total budget. And again, a significant amount of that is now dedicated. In terms of then saying where was the general fund and lottery fund spent in the essential budget level, this is the breakdown for the essential budget level. Not significantly different than we've seen, but again, this is a pie chart of what you would have seen on that other bar chart. So what happened in the governor's recommended budget? First of all, in terms of enhanced funding, this chart gives you, again, the essential budget level first in a bar chart fashion. That's the light-colored side, or the first bar. And that's the cost of the essential budget level. And then you can see the next bar is the governor's recommended area and where the governor has recommended additional funds. And every program area, in this case, since we are in a recovery period, does have additional funding there. Excuse me, I keep going the wrong way. In terms of percentage increases, it's important to always look both ways, because in terms of percentage increases, what you see is that in economic and community development and natural resources actually have the largest percentage increases in the governor's budget. But again, if you saw just this chart, not understanding that they are small dollars, that might look like you can solve all the problems with this, but but clearly they are smaller dollars. But it does give you that perception. What are you going to see? And again, you're going to see these in subcommittees. That essential budget level, how is that constructed? And you will see packages called essential packages. And in effect, there's seven of them. The first one's called vacancy factor. And again, we actually do go into state agencies and adjust for what their experience around recruitment and vacancies have been. The next one is phase-in and roll-ups. That would be for something where you started a program at the end of the biennium with the intention that it be funded for a full 24 months. You can see here it's not horribly significant, and again, this is general fund and lotteries. It's not horribly significant this time. However, if you go back and look at recent history, during the recession, about $1.5 billion of one-time money was in effect used. Remember, our total funds chart never went down, even during the recession, was used to backfill lost or not available general fund. The biennium that followed, that column was somewhere around, I think, $400 to $500 million. So you saw that column actually being a significant driver of dollars in that biennium. There's been a concerted effort to actually reduce the reliance on one-time dollars and to avoid roll-up costs. In this current biennium, I think you obviously see it was very minimal. The next one is phase-out one-time costs. And what you'll notice there is, in general, that's a negative number. And you would expect it to be. This is where you ended a program and said, we want that to go away. And so in the first biennium, you have some savings, but then you have a full 24 months of savings in the next biennium. The reason you see a positive here in the human services area is that interrelationship with federal funds. And as those federal funds went away, they actually did drive, and you will see the next chart gives you total funds, a huge loss of total funds there in terms of phase outs, but it did drive a need in the central services area for some additional general fund to balance that out. Inflation and price list. Okay, inflation, pretty standard in this biennium. What you're seeing is about a standard 3.1% as the standard biennial inflation figure. And certainly that's a huge driver. The other big driver in that inflation number is that the K-12 inflationary dollars, or if you will, the roll-up, which in their case does include all their personal services adjustments, is included in that category. That's the largest driver. Again, you can see almost $700 million alone is in the education arena, and again, the state school fund being the largest component there. The price list is for those agencies like the Department of Administrative Services, the Department of Justice, any agency that you have decided, in effect, is going to charge other agencies for services, either through an assessment or a fee for service, is included in that price list. And so agencies have no control, in effect, over that, and that is included in their budget. As you make changes to those agencies, then you will see that number change in every budget, and those adjustments will be made. Mandated caseload, fairly self-explanatory, Department of Corrections, for example. But again, you will have discussions in some subcommittees over whether or not you agree that everything included in that should be included as a mandated caseload, or are there changes you want there? But again, those are things that today are considered mandated. Fund shifts. The largest one there, you see a negative for education, and again, in this case, and maybe it's not, there's some discussion about moving into a different category, but as we take into account local dollars, those are fund shifted there in that case. But this, was a huge package during the biennium where we were saying, we're not going to use general fund, we're going to fund shift it to another funding source. And then finally, there are some minor technical adjustments. And I was going to try and find an example. I didn't bring it here, I'm sorry. But you will see some other technical adjustments, and analysts will explain those. But those are the primary drivers of what takes you from what was passed last time to that kind of base starting place for this biennium. I'm not going to go through the details of the next chart. That's there. State agency FTE, just finished that discussion. Certainly a large increase. especially after we did not see a large increase last time. It is probably worth mentioning, though, that more than 75% of that increase is in four agencies: Department of Human Services, Higher Education, Department of Corrections, and the Oregon Youth Authority. Some of those increases are related to mandated caseload increases. Some are related to packages and initiatives that are being proposed. But again, you will see, if you saw a pie chart, you really do see that about half of the state agency positions come in the form of about two or three agencies. The largest growth area, clearly, since the early 90s has been in public safety, however. I think about 91, 92, we had about 2,000 state agency positions in the public safety arena, and I believe the last time was around 9,000. So huge growth, a lot of it related to PRISM expansion. Governor's recommended budget, then, again, your essential budget's at $14.060 million. Governor's recommended budget is $14.929 million, so about $870 million difference there. And these are the percentages, again, by those main program areas. And again, you see education being lower than it has traditionally been. You heard some discussion about sustainability, and this is kind of a picture to explain what some of the issues are around sustainability as we look into the future. In budgeting, unless we are in a recessionary period and needing to reduce, budgeters are always trying to look at what does your action today mean for the future. So we took a first look at 09-11. If you assume passage of the governor's recommended budget with all of the governor's initiatives, you could display this in different ways. For example, we could assume that all of the governor's packages and human services passed and show what the impact would be somewhere else. So this is, again, caution. It's just to give a magnitude. But it assumes that public safety is going to grow at its historical trend, that there will be no substantial changes, understanding that Department of Corrections is the primary driver, and it will continue to grow at its historical average. It assumes an education historical growth. It assumes the passage of the education enterprise that's been discussed by the governor and what was included in the governor's budget for funding. Debt service is a little bit here skewed because of just magnitude of dollars. However, this is a real conservative picture on debt service because all it does is assume that it will continue at the same percentage of the budget. We are still gathering, although there are some charts. I would encourage you to read the debt service portion of the summary that explains that in the governor's budget there's a huge growth component here. So this is probably significantly understated. But if you assume those three, what it shows you is that there is insufficient funding to fund even the governor's rec level for human services. So not accounting for any kind of mandated caseloads, inflationary increases, there are less real dollars available to fund human services, and nothing for your all other, which obviously you need to fund some things there. That's the legislative budgets, the Department of Revenue, natural resources, etc. But it's just to give a sense of magnitude of the missing dollars looking out into the future based on the most recent forecast. So again, all of these things are based on the most recent forecast. We, of course, will be updating information as we go forward and getting additional forecasts. But we are traditionally nervous people around future forecasts, especially hearing some of the latest information. That's probably as quick an overview as we can do here.
It's very quick. Thank you, Senator Schrader, and then Representative Hanna.
Just a quick follow-up comment. This last chart that Ms. McHugh references is very, very important because you're going to get hit up by a lot of agencies and advocates that love the governor's budget. No, I love it too. But this chart shows you it's impossible. Not just unattainable, but impossible. So this is why the co-chairs and your subcommittee is going to have to revert back to, you know, perhaps a different level to start the funding discussion. We use the governor's budget as a reference point, certainly. A lot of great work's been done there, but it is totally unsustainable, and so we're going to have to be thoughtful. So as agencies and advocates come to you, you don't just have to explain the facts and just give them a copy of the chart, and I think they would understand.
Thank you. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Teresa, on page 2, the graph that shows the general fund and lottery fund adopted budget, does that include the e-board appropriations, the 12-27?
The 12-272, there's two terms, and this is how I remember them. You will hear a adopted budget. That is the budget that was here when you sunny died for the full body. Then you'll hear the term ledge approved budget. Ledge approved then includes emergency boards and any kind of other interim actions of that nature. So this 12-272 does not include those emergency boards. That is the true budget that was here at the end of last biennium.
Follow up then, please, Madam Chair.
Representative?
I just think it's important then that we note, and I don't know if you have the number with you, but as you set down members of the Ways and Means process, that you look at the e-board adjustments to these budget numbers, because in some cases it significantly increases the amount of dollars that were appropriated to the agencies.
Absolutely.
And not to work from this earlier number.
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, if you actually walk through and because again, some of us probably get overwhelmed and like to do this, but looking at those numbers, it's about 12.45 is including all the emergency boards and special session actions, and then there are other administrative actions, base merit steps that we talked about, et cetera. So you do get to a much higher number, you're correct, before you calculate the essential budget level. And I actually do have some tables that do that for any members that would like to kind of walk through those pieces.
Okay. Last question, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, do you have the comparative data that we can trace back through, say, from 1997 biennium to the present as far as the approved or adopted budgets as such?
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, yes, most of that data is available. It always depends upon how detailed you want to get. We have more information since the new budget system came in place, data that dates beyond before that period. Sometimes at the very detailed level we will have some trouble. But in general, yes, we do have some data.
Just follow-up, if I could, Madam Chair, very quickly.
We're 15 minutes behind, colleagues. And
all right,
we have,
I'll withdraw.
Thank you. Senator, can it wait?
I just wanted to get this on the record, Madam Chair, because I think the last graph that we have, Madam Chair, does make two assumptions. And by making assumptions, it comes to a conclusion where the cuts would be. No enterprise fund has been adopted by the legislature. I have not seen a projection.
Absolutely.
We don't even have projections out that far that would say what we will do after we build the next facility for the Department of Corrections, not in this biennium and the biennium following. And I would like to just ask McHugh one question. If you look at those three...
Senator, I have already turned one of my colleagues down.
Which one of those three areas has the largest general fund increase in the governor's proposed budget? Public safety, education, and human services. Percentage increase.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, that's the question to ask. On percentage increase, it's actually on a percentage increase, it's economic development and natural resources that has the largest increase.
But actually, of the three big ones, it's human services that has.
Correct. Of the three large ones.
Yes.
Okay.
Impressions,
you're getting me in the doghouse here, Senator.
Absolutely, but it does, again, you could start in a different direction.
And I want to make if we could bring the next panel up, I do want to make the point that we're now going to go over the different different program areas within the budget. Certainly everyone who is going to be participating in the full Ways and Means discussions needs to hear this, because you'll be voting on every single budget. But the co-chair and I think it is critically important for members who are serving on only one subcommittee and not serving on the full to also hear this. Because there's tension and interaction and give and take among all the program areas. And if you don't have the context for the whole budget, it would be awfully tempting to sit in a subcommittee and become passionate advocates for that program area
absent the rest of the budget. And we want you to be partners with us in having to balance the entire budget. So I really appreciate your willingness to get briefed on all the areas, even those outside of your subcommittee area. With that, Mr. Bender, are you starting? Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Steve Bender. I'm post-secondary education budget analyst in LFO. Are you with me?
I'm Darren Hill, and I am the K-12 and Department of Education analyst.
Well, they even dress the same.
We're well aware that you're running behind schedule, and we'll try to get through our presentation very quickly and hope that any remaining questions you have, please feel free to ask us at any time.
At the end.
Or even meaning after the meeting. What I'd like to do very briefly is just talk about education and how the state organizes its provision of education services. There are a number of budgets. There are actually two agencies that are involved in pre-K through high school education and four agencies involved in post-secondary education. The Department of Education has two functions. It provides oversight services for the K-12 system. It provides funding for pre-K programs. And it also is the entity through which you distribute funds directly to the school districts and ESDs through the state school fund. The Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development provides oversight and assistance to community colleges, and also through the Community College Support Fund provides funds that are distributed directly to Oregon's 17 community colleges. One thing to note about community colleges is there's a lot of diversity in community colleges in terms of what they do and how what they offer, far more than in any other area of the education system. And just one way of noting this, one way that makes this, I think, immediately obvious, is the largest of all of the community colleges, Portland Community College, has an enrollment on a full-time basis of approximately 23,000 students, whereas the smallest of the 17, Tillamook Bay, only has an enrollment of 300 students. So that's a ratio of 75 times. The largest is 75 times bigger than the smallest. So obviously, there's a lot of different things going on in different community colleges. The state has also been involved recently again in providing funds for capital construction at community colleges. Then there's the Department of Higher Education, which most people just refer to as the Oregon University System. It operates seven institutions, which are also different from each other. They're not all the same by any means, but they don't vary quite as much as the community colleges. And again, just to, in terms of the enrollment, the largest of the OUS institutions is the University of Oregon, with about 19,600 students. So it's almost as big as PCC, but not quite. And the smallest is the Oregon Institute of Technology, with about 2,200 students. Capital construction. The state also supports capital construction at higher education. And the interesting thing to note is that of all of the education providers that you see here, the Department of Higher Education is the only entity that is a state agency in the sense that the actual provision is provided by the state. The employees of the Department of Higher Education are state employees. All other education services, from school district services through community colleges, and as we see next, OHSU, these are non-state entities. So the state is providing funding for other people to provide the education in these cases. The Oregon Student Assistance Commission is the agency that is responsible for a number of programs, but the primary program is the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program, which provides student financial aid to post-secondary ed students. And finally, the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, this is no general fund, but they are involved with licensing personnel in K-12 education. So we'll now go to, oh, I'm sorry, I just wanted to talk very briefly about, again, I think you've seen some of these numbers. Just looking at the general and lottery funds, human services, just to give you an idea of the size of these programs, human services takes up about 22% of those monies in the current biennium, the one we're in now. Then if you add public safety and the judicial branch, so this is what the public safety subcommittee will be focusing on, there's another 16%. Natural resources and other is another 5%. The other would be economic development, administration, legislative branch, those types of things. And the remaining 57% of all general fund and lottery funds go to education. To give you a little bit more idea as to how those are split up amongst the areas we just looked at, 44% of all funds are transferred to school districts. So I think almost half, I mean, that almost is not a technical term, that may be a little bit too much to say almost half or 44%, but if you add 2% that goes to, you know, pre-K through 12 through the Oregon Department of Education, you're up to 46%, so that's closer to almost half, you can say that more accurately. The other 11% goes to post-secondary, 6% to higher ed, 3% to community colleges, and 1% each to OHSU and the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. So post-secondary at about 11% is pretty much the same size as public safety at about 12%. That just gives you some idea of the magnitude. But now we're ready to talk more about pre-K through 12.
And we'll start by talking about the essential budget level for the state school fund. And this was an issue and has been an issue back in 1999. It was finally decided that instead of having several discussions about what the true essential budget level was for the state school fund, that there would be a committee that would be established. And the school revenue forecast committee has been established since then. And basically its number one goal is to determine the essential budget level for a state school fund. It looks at several things in determining those numbers, but the major factors are the local revenues, which we'll talk about here in just a little bit, average daily membership, or basically student counts, teacher compensation, and the PERS rates, the retirement system rates for those teachers. Membership on the committee includes one senator, which is Senator Devlin, and currently the one representative is Representative Morgan. Governor's policy advisor, James Sager, is on there. We have members from the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, one from the Oregon School Boards Association, and one from the Oregon Education Association. There's also what's a little subgroup called the Technical Committee, which includes Department of Education research staff, which is Brian Reeder, Legislative Revenue Office staff, which is Steve Meyer, Budget Management staff, which is Jim Carboni, and Legislative Fiscal Office staff, which is me. The most recent meeting we had was earlier this week, and the current projection for the state portion is $5,826,800,000. The one thing, and Senator Devlin will appreciate this, I am mentioning it because he mentions it quite often, it is a projection, and it will change. We are looking out into the future. As you look at all of those factors, local revenues, and teacher compensation, those kind of things, we are trying to project out 2 years as we're looking at 07-09. And the other issue that probably needs to be raised here, which is that these are, again, looking at statewide averages. In certain categories, certain districts may be higher than what is calculated, and other ones may be lower. But it's a technical process based upon numbers, and the group gets together, and everyone gets their say, and the numbers are then produced. Next, we'll talk about the equalization formula for this state school fund. We could talk for 2 or 3 hours on the formula of how it all works, but we'll get into very
only if you want to be here by yourself.
It actually funds about 200 school districts and 20 education school districts, or ESDs. The formula used to be funding 95% school districts and 5% to the ESDs. It was changed last time, so another 0.25% went to the school districts. The equalization formula was actually adopted in 1991, and it took several years for it to be fully phased in. In general, the way it works is it adds weights, or in some cases actually subtracts weights, depending on different categories. The largest section of it is for special education and at-risk costs, and those include such things as individual education program, which is hearing, speech, and visual impairments, English as a second language, pregnant and parenting, students in poverty, neglected and delinquent, and students in foster care. And each of those
receives an additional weight. So if a student falls into one of those categories, they actually get additional weighting or funding eventually. The one thing to note is that no student may have a total weight of over 2. Some things are actually funded outside of the formula. The small high schools. It was a separate kind of appropriation set aside just for those. It should also be noted that the school districts get reimbursed for transportation costs. And those are anywhere from 90% for the top 10% costs, and the vast majority of folks get funding at 70%. There's also refunding for high-cost disability revenues. Those are the students that cost more than $30,000. School districts get reimbursed for those costs above the $30,000. And there's also facility grants. I'd also like to point out that, just as a side, the payment schedule, there's a July payment, they get 16.67%. And then August through May, all of the school district, the payments go out at 8.33%. And then the adjustments are made from, after all the final numbers are adjustments are made in the next school year. This chart shows the state and local revenues. As you can see, back in the early 90s, before ballot measure 5, it was about a 70-30 split in favor of local. It is now about a 70-30 split in favor of the state. But it should be noted here that when we talk about the total funding, instead of when we say, oh, the state school fund is $5.3 billion or whatever, there is local money that is actually being added to that. In the current biennium, there's about $7.88 billion between local and state. And the governor's budget is projecting about $8.6 billion would be spent. Source of revenues for the state is general fund and lottery funds. Pretty straightforward. There is a little teeny bit of some other funding sources, but it's negligible. On the local revenue side, it's primarily property taxes. There's also the common school fund, county school fund, and sort of other funds. This next chart, there is some confusion at times between how many students do we have in the state, and the biggest thing is the difference between the average daily membership and the average daily membership weighted. And again, that gets back to what I discussed previously on the distribution. 80M is the standard. How many students are there? 80MW are the weighted ones. So how much are there with the weights added to them? The one thing to note here is that both of these are starting to flatten out. If you go back and look back in the late 90s and even as most recently, like in the year 2000, we had some substantial growth percentage-wise. We're now to the point where it's projected to be about 0.1% on the ADM side and about 0.6% on the ADMW side in the next biennium. So those have leveled off substantially. This next chart, we'll just go through real quick. I just have it in there as a point of reference. It just shows funding by each of the two categories. Quickly talk about the Education Stability Fund. The Education Stability Fund receives 18% of net lottery proceeds. Maximum amount is 5% of the general fund revenue. We are currently not there. We have never gotten there. If things continue under current law, it would be about the 11-13 biennium. We would finally get to that point. At that point, if we do fill it up, the rest goes into the capital matching fund. It can be used. The principal can be used. Governor must declare an emergency, and it requires a 3/5 vote of both chambers to actually use that. The proceeds can be then used for anything pre-K through higher ed, including continuing education and workforce training. Interest on the fund is used to pay debt service, and part of it goes to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. Current estimates show that at the end of this biennium, it should be about $230 million. And lastly, I'd talk quickly about the Department of Education. It has several functions within the operations, and actually the department oversees a number of things. Operations is the basic overall leadership responsibilities of both the board and the superintendent. And I've also listed there a number of other programs where oversight is done. Oregon School for the Blind and Oregon School for the Deaf are also under the oversight of the Department of Education. School for the Blind serves about 33 students, and School for the Deaf is about 130. And the one issue there, which has been mentioned and will probably be discussed during budget discussions, is the potential for moving the School for the Blind campus over to the School for the Deaf. Youth Corrections Education Program. These are the general programs for educating those folks both in closed custody facilities and county detention centers. It's actually funded through the state school fund currently, and that's probably another issue that will need to be discussed. That was raised last time. The department is currently looking at options and has had several discussions with folks on whether that's the best way to fund that program or not. The grant and aid program. Grant and aid, it covers a variety of things. The majority of them are federally funded, but the first four that you see here have significant general fund. The Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Education Program is a program that the Early Intervention Program serves youth birth to age two. The Early Childhood Special Education Program is kids three through whenever they start school, usually the age of four or five. And that program is federally mandated. The early intervention program is statutorily mandated. The issue here is there are mandated caseload in there, and in the governor's budget there is some significant increase there of about $12 million. The point here is they have caseloads here have tended to grow, and they were back at the emergency board during the current interim twice to get funding for caseloads there. Oregon Pre-K is currently funded about 60% of all eligibles. The governor's budget funds it at about 80% of all eligibles. It's generally agreed that 80% is about the level where 100% of the folks who would actually opt for it and are eligible would be accepted in the program. So that's why you hear the difference between an 80% and 100%. The rest of the programs here are things that the department by statute is responsible for. Low incidence disabilities are basically regional programs, and long-term treatment and hospital programs as folks and kids of school age are put into some either long-term treatment or hospital programs. Those the department is actually required to pay for those kids' education. The rest of the things here are basically federal programs. The department has a number of grants that they oversee, and most of these programs are all outside of state employees. What you would see is these things are contracted out, and a number of them to ESDs and the school districts, and some of them out to just general contractors. And of course, they also see the state school fund, but we already kind of discussed that.
I'd like to go on to the post-secondary education agencies. Madam Chair, do you have approximately how much time would you like me to fit this into?
Oh, you were supposed to be done at 10 o'clock, so.
Okay.
If you could.
10 and 10,
huh? Can you do it in 4 or 5 minutes?
I will try. I'll just be able to basically leave some information for you. What this is this is looking at trends in post-secondary education funding since 1999-01. And we chose that biennium because that was the biennium before the last recession. Starting in 2001-03, we had the recession hit, and that required reductions in budgets. What this is this takes funding and it normalizes it. So the funding in 99-01 is equal to 100 for each time, each program area. You can see how things have changed and also how the governor proposes to change them further in the future. The important thing to note is if you look at 2005-07, which is where we are now, we have a situation where basically both community colleges and higher ed are receiving the same amount of money as they did in 99-01. It dropped for a while, but now it's about the same level. The state overall, which is the black line there, general fund and lottery, has about 18% more than it did before the recession hit. So clearly, post-secondary education has received less funding than is available generally. It's long below the statewide line, except for the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, which is the amount of student aid that's provided. I heard earlier there was a question about adjusting for inflation. This basically looks at the same numbers adjusted by the change in the consumer price index. So here, if you're at 100, it means you have the same purchasing power in terms of inflation changes that you had in 1999-01. You may be interested in knowing that the state in 05-07 had about the same amount of money adjusted for inflation as it did in 99-01. Okay, so the plus 18% was taken away in terms of through price increases. Of course, at the same time, a lot of other things happened. There were more people in the state. There were changes in the amount of federal funds available. But this just basically shows what happened to the state. This shows how the legislature has worked to increase funding for student aid for the Oregon Student Assistance Commission program. For higher ed, you can see that this is higher ed and community colleges both are at about the same place right now, in that they're both about 15% on an inflation-adjusted basis. Their funding from the state is 15% less than it was before the recession hit. And again, this does not account for any changes in student enrollment or anything like that. So these community colleges are pretty similar. There's a somewhat different pattern, but right now they're at the same place pretty much. Oregon Health Sciences University funding is about half of what it was before the recession hit, once you adjust for inflation. Now the question is, why has this happened? This is certainly not the way the state budgets for post-secondary education. They don't pick numbers and just say, well, it's funded at that level. The decisions are made through a process of looking at the budgets and looking at the alternatives. This basically tells the outcomes of what those decisions were. I want to explain perhaps why the legislature made these decisions, because I think it's fair to say that people in the legislature did not reduce funding because they thought that post-secondary education had too much money. It was due to other reasons. And the main reason was that as the state dealt with its budget problems, post-secondary education was unique in that it was one of the few, if perhaps the only, general fund supported program for which there is an alternative fund source that can be utilized. And the alternative fund source is primarily tuition. So what has happened over this period of time is tuitions have increased very rapidly, greatly increasing costs to students. But we can see what the effect has been. This again is, well, I'm not adjusting for inflation anymore, but this is the funding for higher ed. It was lower this is just the education in general portion of the budget. So it was actually lower in 05-07 than it was in 99-01. Not inflation adjusted, just in actual dollars. When you add other funds, though, most of which are tuition, you can see that if you look at the top, the funding in 05-07 was not less than it was in 99-01. In fact, it was about 36% higher. So due to increases primarily in tuition, the overall budget has increased by 36% over this period of time. At the same time, tuition rates for resident undergraduates have increased by approximately 60% over this period of time. So because of these very large tuition increases, the system has been able to continue to expand expenditures. Currently, in the current biennium, tuition covers about 53% of the costs in the education in general limited budget. And the general fund is only supplying about 36%, and then about 11 or 12% comes from other sources, non-tuition, non-general fund. Community colleges have a similar situation in that this is their funding from the state, and yes, for them, the funding was also a little less in 05-07 than it was in 99-01. But they have two additional sources of revenue. They have tuition, as did higher ed, plus property taxes. Like K-12 schools, they have property taxes that they collect as well. So again, even though funding for tuition for community colleges at the state level hasn't increased, when you add these three sources by 05-07, total funding from these three primary sources is about 26% up from 99-01. Not up as much as it is for higher ed. It was a smaller rate of increase. And you may want to, an obvious question is, well, why don't you have tuition for 07-09? That's because we don't know what it's going to be. It's going to be set independently by community college boards. OHSU, where the funding is dropped by a third, has other funds as well. Their university, they have other funds from tuition and other revenues for their university, which has enabled their expenditures to grow. And if you add in their hospital expanding, the revenues from their hospital, the growth rate has even been higher. Finally, capital construction. This shows the state-supported capital construction in which the state is either paying for the costs or is paying for debt service on these projects. Both community colleges and higher ed also finance large capital construction budgets with their own revenues that don't include anything that the state is providing. You can see that in 05-07, the amount was expanded, and that community colleges received state support for the first time over this period, in fact, for the first time since the 1979-81 biennium. Briefly there, you can see the governor has a large capital construction budget proposed for higher ed and community colleges. If you do approve that, the debt service will eventually be about $70 million per biennium on that 07-09 GRB. That was a very quick one.
It was, and thank you, Mr. Bender. Very well done. Questions from members? Representative Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bender, looking at page 7, if you go back on the higher ed budget, I know you might not have these numbers handy.
Sure.
Do you have a sense of what that trend would have been if you would have gone back to, say, the 95 biennium?
There were certainly increases between 95 and 99, so I would have to check that up again.
So maybe some jumps, but then it came back down.
Yeah. Post-secondary education funding, and it's not only in Oregon, it's in all states, is counter-cyclical in that whenever there's a recession, states tend to hit post-secondary ed more than other areas of the budget simply because of the fact that there is the other revenue sources available.
Thank you. Representative Galizia.
Now, Mr. Bender, two questions. One is, when you mentioned the 60% increase in tuition for OUS over that period, does that include fees? And then my second question is, what was, over the same period, the community college tuition increase, and let us know if it includes fees.
In both cases, Representative Galizio, it does include the mandatory fees. And for community colleges, the rate of increase over the same period of time was higher. It was closer to 80%.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, this is not a question, but a request. Much of the data, and not just on education, but much of the data is impressionistic by virtue of graphs without backup. And I'm wondering if it would be possible to have access to the Excel spreadsheets that drive these graphs so that we can, in fact, look more thoughtfully at the numbers, and if you could just maybe provide our offices the place where we could go in LFO to actually get drilled down to the specific numbers would be really helpful, at least from my perspective, Madam Co-Chair.
Good idea. Senator, are you asking for the actual numbers, or do you want the electronic document?
Well, the electronic document, if it was possible to have, but if it had the backup Excel, maybe, or the spreadsheet behind it, so that when you show a number, or you show a bar, what's the corresponding number? So the actual hard data was available to us.
What I'd suggest is, rather than flood everybody with that information, we'll provide paper copies for the full committee, and those who want the electronic documents, Mr. Bender will tell you how to get them or provide those specifically to you.
Thank you.
Senator Wessling.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And not to take umbrage with the detail request of Senator Morris, but those graphs were plain enough, and they should speak loudly to us. You know, I don't speak just for the institutions of higher learning in my district, but the institutions of higher learning in all of our districts and the citizens that so vitally depend on them. There is no area in the state budget that we have not given its fair respect. I mean, you could see the graph. I mean, we've made up for this, and Steve was very articulate in saying, look, you know, there's kind of a safety valve there in terms of student assistant, and that's putting a Band-Aid on the artery cut in funding these institutions. Well, we neglect the infrastructure, deferred maintenance, additional faculty that is so vital for the continued success of this state. So it's just something I want us all to take note as we go forward with the very, very difficult budget decisions we're going to have to make. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. Vice Chair Carter.
Thank you, Representative Nolan. I just wanted to bring a little levity to the committee this morning.
Thank you.
And that you can tell who's the youngest member in Ways and Means because it's the smallest writing here.
I will echo that as I'm getting adjusted to bifocals myself. Senator Schrader.
Well, 2 points for the full committee and the policy members, I think, to pay attention to that have driven some of the decisions, some of the concerns, at least from this co-chair's perspective, especially during the recession. One is the tuition increases noted here. Last session, there was a concerted attempt to limit those and work collaboratively with their Oregon University system to balance out the scholarship aspect with the tuition aspect. And OFFS did some work to show the impact that tuition increases had both on community colleges and the Oregon University system. The community colleges have not been held to the same standard, and I would hope the Education Subcommittee would work collaboratively so that both OUS and the community college system have some understanding of what the expectation is given whatever funding we are able to give them this coming session. The other piece, and it's much more controversial, well, that's pretty controversial, but much more controversial would be Oregon Health Sciences University. For those of us that have been in the building a while, there's two aspects of this. You know, one is trying to get a good handle on what is their state mission. Oftentimes, different agencies, when it serves their purpose, want to become state agencies. When it serves their purpose, they'd rather be private. And as you know, OHSU is a public-private corporation. The issue here is the funding level. There are many of us that believe that a deal was struck back in early 90s about $100 million funding level from the state. We'll cut you loose on that basis, go forth and do good work. I think Oregon Health Sciences University makes a good point. Well, that may or may not be exactly how we remember it, but by all accounts and purposes, we would like you to at least pay attention to the public side of our mission, i.e. the med school, dental school, nursing school, AHEX, that sort of thing. And, there are inflationary costs for us to do the same level of work we did 10 years ago. We were going to need some additional revenues, and that's been the tension or discussion point in the last few years, and hopefully the Education Subcommittee will come to some good conclusions that way.
I'm sure they'll come to good conclusions on that one. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Chair Nolan. Mr. Hill, in the Legislative Revenue Office 2007 report, it states on page G9 that using the ABM adjusted for inflation, the revenue per student in K-12 adjusted for inflation has actually increased 12%, or about 12% over the last 10 years. Do you concur with that?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, without having the report in front of me, I can give you my opinion on that, but Steve Meyer, who would put that together, I'm sure has the numbers right.
Okay.
Actually, it's gone down. If you adjust it for inflation caseload initiative process, I can give you a good chart that will show you it's gone down.
Okay. Senator Whitsitt?
perhaps that's true, Co-Chair, but it's right here on black and white in the most recent LRO report, that in fact it's a 12% on ADM and 7% on ADMW.
We ought to get that clarified. Thanks. Senator Devlin.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, because this is a session where we're supposed to get sort of an overview and look, I think that one of the things I'd like to put on the record here is I think sometimes we lack our peripheral vision. We seem to be all focused just on general fund and lottery fund, and that's a portion of the budget, and not looking at what are impacting our requirements in those budgets. For instance, in K through 12, both Measure 5 and Measure 50. But Measure 50 actually more recently, obviously, in a different kind of an impact, because Measure 50 has levelized the growth in property taxes, while our income taxes have grown faster. So we've had to backfill more. Community colleges and higher ed, if they don't get dollars from us, they get it in tuition. Also, in terms of community colleges, if you want to look at really something that's just probably the most broken portion of the education system in terms of funding, the amount that community colleges have that's left in property taxes is an amount that's been determined by default, not by design. It varies widely. It's basically what's left over. And, I mean, even if you go beyond these budgets and you go on to human services, just looking at the general fund and not realizing what's happening with federal funds, too much, I think, we get caught into this peripheral vision and we're not looking at the other things that are impacting the budgets in terms of how things are funded.
Thank you, Senator. And I want to make sure that when we look through the other program areas, we are focusing on the $49 billion that we are stewards for and not just the $14 billion in the general and lottery funds. Good point. Thank you, gentlemen.
Madam Co-Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. This is not a question, but given the editorializing on the part of others, I beg your indulgence for a quick comment for the Ways and Means full and the subs to bear in mind that when we ask, when the sub-chair asked the question about the tuition percentage increases, he noted, I think we got a figure in excess of 80% increase over the period of time. And I make the notation that this is for the students who probably are least able to pay and, you know, more confined to where they may be headed for and perhaps often least available for other types of scholarships and things of this nature. So I hope the sub-chair will take this into consideration when we get to the committee, and I hope the other members of the Ways and Means Committee will be very understanding when that happens.
Thank you, Representative. I think we've achieved our objective of helping people understand the interplay among the program areas. Thank you. Could we get the Human Services Program folks to the podium? Ms. Baker, are you first up?
No, Madam Chair.
Mr. Britton.
Oh, God. Good morning to you, too.
Good comeback.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, and members of the Ways and Means Committee. My name is John Britton, and my colleague Sheila Baker is with me this morning. And
thank you.
Let's see if we can get this thing to go. The first slide lists the agencies that are within the Human Services Program area. The largest is the Department of Human Services, and Sheila and I share that analyst responsibility. I have responsibility for health services and seniors and people with disabilities. Sheila has responsibility for the children, adults, and families, as well as the department-wide support services. The Office of Private Health Partnerships, formerly known as the Insurance Pool Governing Board, is one of my agencies. State Commission on Children and Families is one of Sheila's agencies. The next three, the Commission for the Blind, the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, the Psychiatric Security Review Board, are all under the domain of Deborah Manthe, who is one of our colleagues. She also has the Board of Medical Examiners, which is not technically a human services program area agency, but it is assigned to the Human Services Subcommittee. Likewise, the Board of Nursing is assigned to the Human Services Subcommittee, and our colleague Tim Walker is the analyst for that agency. The Human Services Program Area's total funds budget, about $12.2 billion, and it comprises about 25% of the overall state budget, almost $49.2 billion, and it is second only to the Education Program Service Area in terms of total funds. General and lottery funds are less than 30% of the human services budget. The majority is about 60% federal funds. Now, what's the point? Well, this drives a good deal of what we do in the human services program area. Daryl Royal, who was the University of Texas football coach for many years, had an expression, and I think Shania Twain has picked it up. It's called, dance with the one who brung you, right?
That's a good one.
And in this particular program budget, we are looking at federal funds comprising a huge amount. They're the ones who, in many respects, call a lot of the shots. And, in fact, they also drive much of the general fund contribution to this budget as well, because most of the general fund is used to match federal funds, particularly in the areas of Medicaid and CHIP, or to provide a maintenance of effort or to meet a maintenance of effort requirement in such federal programs as the temporary assistance to needy families. Lottery funds here are only about $12 million, and they are exclusively dedicated to gambling addiction treatment. Other funds include tobacco taxes. In the governor's recommended budget, we're looking at about $560 million of tobacco taxes. Also, a significant portion of other funds are Medicaid provider taxes, which we'll learn about more in the subcommittee. Those include managed care plan provider taxes, hospital provider taxes, and nursing facility provider taxes. Other funds also include an expenditure in the 07 or a proposed expenditure in 07-09 of about $85 million of certificate of revenue from certificates of participation for the Oregon State Hospital Replacement Project. As I noted earlier, the federal funds, the vast majority of those federal funds are Medicaid, but there is also temporary assistance to needy families, Title 20 social services block grant, and also a huge share of non-limited federal benefits for food stamps and grants for women, infants, and children's program. This chart shows the percentage of general and lottery funds over the years that the Human Services Program Area has used of the state budget. You can see back in 1995-96 that it was about 23.5% of the state general fund and lottery fund. In the governor's recommended budget, it's about 22.9%. And it's varied a little bit over the years. What's important to note here is that even a small share increase, however, can be some significant dollars. In 2005-07, this comprised about 22.3%, and that increase up to 22.9% is worth about $90 million. If, on the other hand, we'd maintained the same share as we did in 1995, that 23.5%, in the 07-09 budget, we'd have $93 million above the level that's proposed in the governor's recommended budget. But there are two other points that need to be made about this particular slide. It's somewhat misleading. And that, by that I mean the way that that share has been held down to 21, 22, 23% has been the infusion of a lot of other fund sources, most notably provider taxes, I mentioned those a second ago, as well as more and more tobacco taxes over the years. And the second point is that the reason that the share has been held down to some degree has been the fact that we've cut budgets. And we reduced, for example, our Oregon Health Plan Standard Program. At one point, it had 100,000 enrollees. Today, it has about 20,000. The Medically Needy Program was eliminated, and there were service cuts to Medicaid long-term care as well. So that has dampened the increase of the share in terms of human services, in terms of the human services program area.
Forgive me, Madam Co-Chair, but that's 80,000 human beings have gone to help keep that number at the percentage it is. It's one of the depressing effects. 80,000 human beings that aren't receiving essential health care services.
Notwithstanding the fact that the share has remained fairly stable, it is interesting to note that since 2003-05, the general fund has grown by 46%, and total funds is up about 33%. This chart shows a comparison of 2003-05 actuals, 2005-07 legislatively approved budget, not adopted, but approved budget, the calculated essential budget level, which, as Teresa noted earlier today, includes personal services roll-up costs, inflation, which is a significant factor in this particular budget area, program phase-ins and phase-outs, mandatory caseload growth, as well as funding shifts. The other thing to note is that the $1 billion increase from the essential budget level to the governor's budget consists, at least half of it consists, of phasing back in those Medicaid provider taxes. All of them are, under current law, will sunset during the 2007-09 budget period, but the governor's budget does anticipate their continuation, but that will take legislative action. The next slide shows that 83% of the human services funds goes to counties, all kinds of human services providers, and to some clients directly. And this is an important fact about this program service area, because whenever we talk about increases to this program service area or decreases, we're talking about providers, their livelihood, how they do business, their reimbursement rates, and all of those kinds of things. And they have a great deal, as you well know, a great deal of interest in the budget process. But 83% of the budget is going out into the communities around the state, hospitals, doctors, nursing homes, assisted living facilities, training programs, and the like. Capital outlay and debt service costs are primarily related to information technology systems and, again, to that Oregon State Hospital replacement project. Personal services covers about 10,311 positions. And human services, it's interesting to note, has about 20% of the statewide 50,000 FTE, 20% of the 50,000 FTE. And most of those folks are case managers and their support staff out in the field providing services to people or organizing those services. I hope you leave with the impression today that human services drivers, budget drivers, are varied and complex. They rely upon population characteristics, how many poor folks we have in this state, children, elderly, relies upon what the economy is doing. And again, this is countercyclical typically. That is, when the economy is doing very well, the population in Oregon doesn't need human services or doesn't demand human services programs quite as much, but when the recession hit, the Department of Human Services and other agencies were hit pretty hard. And that was the very time that the legislature was forced, because of a declining revenue forecast, to make cuts. So, again, some risk here. As I already said, federal law and funding is a critical piece. It's a critical budget driver. When Congress passes laws or the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services generate new regulation, it does have an effect here in Oregon, as it does in all the other states. Legal action has been a major driver of budgets over the recent years. You'll hear about court cases known as, for example, Staley, Harmon, which affected the Oregon State Hospital during this past biennium, Spry, and so on. So advocates have used, and clients have used, the legal system or the justice system to make modifications to programs, and those are considerations that we always have to make. Health cost or health care cost inflation and utilization in the essential budget level for the Department of Human Services, there is a 15% assumption about cost care inflation and utilization increases over the 2007-09 biennium. We'll wait and see if that holds. And in fact, when the governor submits what is known as a reshoot based on new information sometime this spring, that may go down, it may go up. But for now, the governor's budget assumes a 15% increase in medical costs, for example, in the Oregon Health Plan. State Human Services policy directions, and I'm thinking here primarily of the emphasis over the years that Oregon has placed upon preventive kinds of measures, or trying to get folks involved in the system a little bit earlier than otherwise to hasten or to slow down their decline. I'm thinking in terms of Medicaid long-term care, trying to provide community-based service options and intervening before these folks become really disabled and need more expensive care. And, of course, politics, I guess it goes without saying, but again, I remind you, 83% of this budget is special payments. And you have met, or you will meet, just about all of these providers at one time or another who are concerned about their reimbursement levels and what policy decisions you folks will be making. We want to turn now and look at three of the agencies within the Human Services Program area, beginning with the largest, the Department of Human Services. Sheila?
Thank you. As you can see from the next slide, the Department of Human Services has by far the largest share of the Human Services program area. It's about 98% of the funding for this whole program area. We're also going to talk about the Commission on Children and Families and Office of Private Health Partnerships, because they have significant chunks as well. The other agencies, Commission for the Blind, Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and Psychiatric Security Security Review Board, the subcommittee will be dealing with, but we won't be covering those today. The next slide gives you a laundry list, basically, of what the statutes say the Department of Human Services is responsible for. We just wanted to lay those out there so you can see the breadth of their responsibilities. We will be talking about in more detail where in the agency and what the budget impacts of those particular responsibilities are, but we did want to portray that for you. The next slide shows the organization of the Department of Human Services $12 billion total funds budget. There are five major budget areas. Children, adults, and families takes up about 21% of the budget. Health services is more than half of the budget. That's particularly physical and mental health services. Seniors and people with disabilities takes up about a quarter of the budget. Department-wide support services, the central administrative and policy and support functions are about 4% of the budget. And then capital improvements and capital construction are less than 1% of the budget. John noted that come spring, we expect that the governor will reshoot his budget proposal for 2007-09. Department, those of you that have been on Ways and Means or the Interim Emergency Board are familiar with the department's budget rebalancings. Those happen during session as well as during the interim. So in the spring, we expect we will get a rebalance of the current biennium budget for the Department of Human Services, and then the changes therein will also translate into 2007-09 in many cases. So we will have a rebalance of the current biennium budget and a reshoot of the 07-09 budget. So these numbers will be changing, and perhaps the issues will be changing as well. So we're going to turn now to the areas within the Department of Human Services budget, talk about major programs and services and what drives their budget. In the children, adults, and families area, major programs and services are organized around self-sufficiency. Things like food stamps, temporary assistance to needy families, cash benefits, employment-related daycare, jobs, employment and training, and support services. The child welfare piece is within the children, adults, and families budget. In previous lives, this was known as the State Office for Children and Families or Children's Services Division. Some people will still call it that. It includes the child protective services functions, substitute care, predominantly foster care, but also residential treatment kinds of things, and then adoptions, particularly adoption assistance payments. Another element within the children, adults, and family structure is vocational rehabilitation services. So those services are part of the self-sufficiency effort, but separately organized. And then one of the major elements of the budget that you'll see in children, adults, and families is the field staffing who provide the program support. The bulk of children, adults, and family services are delivered through field offices throughout the state. The next budget outlines some of the significant cost drivers in the essential budget level for children, adults, and families. The most noteworthy there is the first bullet point, caseload roll-up, and then projected caseload growth into the next biennium. For 2007-09, this is estimated at about $115 million total funds, and attached to that are almost 200 positions. So there's significant caseload growth in foster care, adoptions assistance, food stamps, and then eligibility determination for the Oregon Health Plan, which is largely done through the children, adults, and families staff. Another cost driver is cost of living adjustments, particularly affecting provider payments and client benefits. If you'll remember in the last budget, the cost of living adjustment for most Department of Human Services programs was phased in during the biennium. They didn't get a full 24 months cost of living adjustment, so there is an increase in that budget to make up for that 6 months that they didn't get during 05-07, basically to roll it forward for 24 months, and then the other inflation cost of living adjustment for 07-09 as well. And then the third bullet point there, I just wanted to highlight because it affects a number of other areas within Department of Human Services. There are fund shifts within each of the budget areas that don't affect the total funds budget, but do significantly affect the general fund requirement for those. Examples of that are for Medicaid and foster care and adoption assistance, which are matched programs with federal funds. The state's share varies depending on how the state economy is doing relative to the national economy. And so there is a determination of the federal matching percentage that varies over time. Because our economy has been improving the last couple years, the state has had to pick up more of a share of the program expenditures, so our federal funds are dropping. So you have an increased general fund requirement, fewer federal funds available. So that's one of the reasons that you'll see in the DHS budget for increased general fund need.
We'll move now to the health services budget area within the Department of Human Services. The major programs and services, of course, are the Oregon Health Plan, and when we talk about the Oregon Health Plan, we also are including not just Medicaid caseloads, but also the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP. It is actually a separate program from Medicaid itself. It has a separate match rate, and its funds, unlike Medicaid, are capped. So there is an allocation given to each state. Medicaid, depending on how much state match you put up, you can keep acquiring Medicaid funds, and there is no specific limit to each state. However, remember that the feds also require us to be very clear with them about how much we expect to be spending. They have to approve our state plan as far as who we're going to be covering, what services we're going to be providing. Second major area within health services is the addiction and mental health services, including the Oregon State Hospital and the community programs, both for substance abuse and mental health, that in many respects attempt to limit intake into the Oregon State Hospital. And that's a really important point. We'll talk about that in just a few minutes a little bit more. Finally, within health services, a small amount of money, relatively speaking, about 5% of the special payments budget, more when it comes to considering staff, but that is public health. And oftentimes, because it has not a whole lot of general fund in its budget, we kind of overlook it. But the fact is that since the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, most of the life expectancy gains within the United States have been attributed to public health. So, small amount of budget, but a great impact upon how we live today. The essential budget level cost drivers are a changing mix of the Oregon Health Plan caseload. It's not expected as a total caseload to go up very much during the 2007-09 biennium, but depending on who is showing up, that can have an impact on our costs. We do not pay, for example, the same amount in terms of a capitation payment to managed care plans, for example, for every member. Children cost less. Persons with disabilities typically cost more. So that mix of caseload is as important as the total numbers in terms of the Oregon Health Plan caseload. We do anticipate children's health insurance plan caseload growth, apart from the governor's initiative, which is the Healthy Kids Plan. We also, as I noted earlier, anticipate health care cost increases, again 15% assumed in the governor's budget. Could be less as the spring unfolds and we get more information about that, but for now 15%. I also mentioned the end of the managed care organization and hospital provider taxes, at least in terms of the calculation of the essential budget level. But as I said earlier, the governor's budget assumes that those provider taxes will be continued through legislative action. I would also point out that apart from a proposal to increase tobacco taxes, that is a fairly flat funding source, and we are not seeing within the governor's budget any use within this budget of the tobacco settlement revenues. Pete Shepard from the Attorney General's office mentioned the other day to you folks that was a bone of contention with the cigarette manufacturers. And in fact, this past spring, DHS lost about $9 million of anticipated funding because of that dispute. Next major budget area, the seniors and people with disabilities, about $2.8 billion. Major programs, long-term care, again driven by Medicaid. This is an important part of Medicaid, but again sometimes overlooked because it's not quite as big as the acute care side of things. Oregon Project Independence, and a smaller program, general fund only, known as spousal pay. Programs for persons with developmental disabilities. This is also a large part of this particular budget area. Federal Older Americans Act, and a modest amount of direct financial support that is linked with the Supplemental Security Income grant that is provided to persons with disabilities. And, of course, field staff who provide program support. That field staff includes both state employees, but it also includes some employees of area agencies on aging. Essential budget level cost drivers. Growing caseloads in long-term care and support services for persons with developmental disabilities, and I emphasize developmental disabilities, those caseloads are growing. However, the seniors and people with physical disabilities as a total caseload is actually expected to be flat for the 2007-09 biennium. I attended a forecast meeting this morning at the department, and that's what they're looking for, and the governor's budget reflects that expectation. Increasing long-term care costs, not to the magnitude, of course, in the acute care arena, but still some increases in those costs. And at least for the essential budget level, the end of the nursing home Medicaid provider tax.
As I mentioned earlier, department-wide support services is the entity that provides the central policy and program support for the department, but most of the budget is tied up with its basic administrative operations, accounting, budgeting, those types of functions. In terms of the essential budget level, the cost drivers in this area are primarily debt service for information systems projects that were started in prior biennia and continue to be underway, but for which certificates of participation financing was made available, and now the department is paying the debt service on that. So, for example, their debt service increases from about $5 million in the current biennium to almost $11 million in the 07-09 biennium, and that's without any additional costs that might be associated with the Oregon State Hospital replacement or other new information systems projects. The next slide, we want to touch very briefly on major issues that we will be looking at during the session in the Department of Human Services. And I say very briefly because each of these have significant nuances and consequences and all of that, and we will get into that in more detail in the subcommittee, certainly. The first issue, for those of you that have been on board during the interim, are familiar with this, agency operations and financial management. The agency has had this at legislative direction as a major focus during the current biennium, and that will continue into the next. DHS, the Department of Human Services, needs a sound financial infrastructure so that they can track their expenditures, so their managers can manage their programs and assure that the money is spent efficiently, all the while meeting state and federal requirements. So they've had a review team that looked at their processes. The department is implementing a number of those recommendations. The governor's budget funds some of them, but we expect that there will be more forthcoming. The agency is to report to the legislature by March 1st on a plan to address its cash flow issues for the current biennium and any other operational improvements that it feels need to be made.
Ms. Baker, so that you still have some people at the podium when you finish, I suggest you skip to the next program areas, and we'll just ask the subcommittees to pay particular attention to the details of the major issues.
Talk briefly about the Office of Private Health Partnerships, the Insurance Pool Governing Board, major programs, the Family Health Insurance Program, which provides subsidies to individuals, and also through group insurance plans as well, so that people can get commercial health insurance. And it is part of the Oregon Health Plan. It is part of the waivers in the state plan that we have in place for Medicaid and for our Children's Health Insurance Program. Issues, primarily the OPHP role in Healthy Kids. They have about $22 million of tobacco tax, and they are to provide the marketing and outreach efforts to make this thing work.
The State Commission on State Commission on Children and Families is the last agency that we will touch on here. Their role is a little less well understood, perhaps, than the Department of Human Services in delivering services, but the major program and services are outlined there. They're a facilitating group. They pass through money. They support local commissions on children and families in the areas that are identified there. In the next biennium, what you will be hearing revolves around what they call the Partners for Children and Families, which is a mix of local and state entities that are working together, have been working together on children's issues. So that coordination will continue, and there are some proposals regarding homeless and a runaway and other issues, community schools particularly, that the legislature has been interested in that will be continuing. There is an issue about the Healthy Start program. The program was redirected by budget note in the 2005 session, and the agency is to report on what they've done there. And then the governor's budget put some additional resources in that program, so that's an issue that you will want to be looking at. And then, as in some other areas of the budget, there are some program restorations and some enhancement funding, both for money that passes through to local commissions on children and families, as well as other programs such as the court-appointed special advocate program that you will be hearing about. The next slide is lifted from a slide that was used during the last session, just to give you a graphic for what the Commission on Children and Family and its partner agencies is involved with, ranging from primary prevention efforts on the left-hand side over to the corrections remediations on the right-hand side. And obviously I'm not going to go through all of these, but the bottom line message is that along that prevention continuum, less cost, more served on the primary prevention side, higher cost, fewer served on the corrections and remediation side. The trick that you have is, of course, to balance those costs and benefits along that continuum with the state and local agencies that are involved in those for optimal outcomes. And then our last slide is just to highlight linkages from this human services program area with other state and local entities. We've talked about some of those you can see in the slide. Some of them that are less obvious would be, for example, Department of Consumer and Business Services. There's linkages with workers' compensation, with housing and community services. That entity has financed a number of the group homes for mental health and developmentally disabled people in the Department of Human Services. judicial, public safety, education, I think those are pretty much self-explanatory, but they are linkages and they will have an impact on the budget decisions that are being made during this interim. So that concludes our overview. If you have questions, you have our detailed analysis and you know where we live down the hall.
Thank you very much. Do I have questions?
Very quick.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. One just quick question. Senator Devlin had mentioned that human services had the largest percentage increase. Do you know what the increase is in the DHS budget, general fund and lottery, in the governor's budget compared to 507 legislatively approved?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Shields, let's see, for the Department of Human Services, the general fund budget is 23% more than the 2005-07 legislatively approved budget. A lot of that is due to inflation, including the health care cost increases that John referred to, and caseload changes.
Great, thanks.
Thanks, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. A question about revenue sources. A lot of the money that comes in is from federal funds. Do we have a list, however, of what I might characterize as unclaimed revenue, of revenue that we could be eligible for if we had matching money? Do we have a list and an idea of the scope or magnitude of that money that would be available?
I don't have a list of that, Representative Nathanson. We can talk to the department about that. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was astounded when I sat here and watched one of your slides because everything I've seen says our senior population is growing tremendously, is in the process of actually doubling, that Oregon's percentage of seniors is one of the highest in the nation. And to see a slide that says long-term care is flat, boy, I got some questions about that.
Representative Nolan and Representative Gerard, absolutely. My brief answer to that is that the wave is coming, for sure. But that we are in, there are a couple of things going on. One of the things that is dampening that long-term care senior caseload is the fact that the Medicaid Modernization Act took place. And this will illustrate the linkage between programs. What we believe is that a lot of folks were getting on Medicaid long-term care, particularly in the in-home program area, because they needed in-home care, to be sure, but also because they wanted a prescription drug benefit. And when the federal government now provides that through Medicare, Part D, a lot of the folks that were coming onto the caseload seeking that prescription drug benefit through Medicaid are no longer doing so. So you're correct in terms of the overall population and the demographics, and again, the wave is going to hit. But for now, we believe that that MMA had a real impact in terms of dampening the caseload that we're paying for through this budget.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Britton, I'd like to direct your attention to page 3, the slide at the top, an outprinted version. I wonder if I can see these figures expressed on a per capita basis as opposed to a percentage of the general fund, lottery fund revenue. I'd just like to better understand the impact over time.
And you're talking about the human services has been 22% of state, that particular slide.
Correct.
Representative Edwards? Sure, we can do that.
Senator Devlin.
Mr. Britton, you made a comment that I just wanted to get a clarification on the two different EBLs, and that the largest difference between that is my understanding is the first EBL, I'm trying to get this clear in my mind, you had to do, the largest determiner is the extension of provider taxes, so that when you did the budget, you had to base it on current law, which was then expiring, and the governor presumes that they're going to be renewed. The question there is, if they're not renewed, is the primary impact a decline in reimbursement rates
And if that is the case, wouldn't that have some secondary impacts in terms of actual services being provided? Or are providers willing to provide services?
Chair Nolan and Senator Devlin, the hospital and the managed care provider taxes are used to support OHP standard. Now, there is some reimbursement in there as well, but it's primarily for services to people, to the 20,000 folks that are on OHP standard today.
So without the provider tax, then you'd have
that
to
goes away.
Whether
that,
discontinuing it or finding other sources of funds to fund it.
That's exactly correct. On the other hand, the nursing facility provider tax is used exclusively for reimbursement.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Very high-level overview, but really important issues to understand how they interact. Mr. Wilson, I see only one of you.
For brevity's sake, I'm going to do the entire
presentation.
But I do want to make sure folks know who the other analysts in this area are. They're sitting back here. One is Robin Lamont, who does most of the judiciary branch, John Borden, who does military and a couple of small judiciary branch agencies, and Sheila Baker, who is just at the table, does the youth authority. I do all the others in public safety.
Thank you.
This is the list of the public safety agencies that are part of this subcommittee assignment. We like to think of these as a system, and you'll hear throughout the session that public safety and judiciary program areas are really combined, and you will see they refer to as public safety throughout this presentation, but they are interrelated too in many ways. For example, for the Board of Parole, their entire workload is based on who comes out of the Department of Corrections generally, who are on probation and or post-prison supervision. Department of Correction depends on the courts, the DAs, and other people on the prosecution side system for all their clients who are inmates or offenders. So this whole system is interrelated. Really, the only agency in this list that you have in front of you that really doesn't fit into the public safety realm in that way, but is still very important in public safety generally, is the military department. Moving on, and I know we are running about 20 minutes behind. Again, you've seen variants of this particular pie chart or graph. Public safety represents 16% of the total general fund and lottery fund spending. It is mostly general fund and lottery spending, so its share of the entire budget is probably less than that in terms of total funds. The next graph shows you how it has changed over an extended period of time from 91-93 to the governor's budget in 07-09. You'll see that it has increased its proportional share of lottery and general funds by roughly 3% over that 15-20-year period.
Mm-hmm.
And most of that will be in Department of Corrections. And in fact, if you take a look at just a measure of how Department of Corrections drives this public safety program area, if you take a look at the growth of the number of FTE over that period in the budgets in 93-95, between 93-95 and 07-09, all of the public safety agencies rose by about 50% of the number of FTE. Department of Corrections grew at over 90% during that same period. And we'll get into the reasons for that in a minute. The next graph just shows you the funding sources for this area. I've added one that doesn't generally come up that is rather unique to public safety, and that's criminal fines and assessment. But generally, this is a general fund, primarily funded program area representing almost 70% of the budget, or $2.29 billion. Federal funds play a smaller role, but major roles in Department of Justice for child support, a major funder for the military department, and smaller funding for the other agencies in the program area. Other funds, 19% or $639 million. Most of that you'll find in Department of Justice, which which a lot of that are the fees they charge for attorney and legal services to other state agencies. The military department has over $200 million in other funds. Or state police has a substantial amount. I'll talk to them in a minute about them in a minute. OIA and the judicial department has a large amount of other funds in this current budget, in the governor's budget, but a lot of that is for the development of a replacement system for their major information management system. The next two slides just show you by department or agency the funding, the amount of funding as well as the funding source, the red being the general fund. Lottery funds are rather limited in one specific agency, and that's state police for fish and wildlife related enforcement for ballot measure 66. Other funds, you can see there in the blue, state police has the largest amount of these other funds, but as a warning, or as just a note here, almost $485 million of that other funds in the state police is for capital construction for the Orwin project of the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network System, or Orwin. So really, in terms of the other funds and the size of the state police budget, it almost doubles because of that one item, which is a one-time amount and their limitation. You can go down the list there. As you can see, except for Department of Justice and military, most are primarily general funded agency, public safety standards and training, which is DPSST. Most of their funding comes from criminal fines and assessment that you saw in the previous slide. And the only general fund used there is for debt service for their new facility that opened about 6-7 months ago. On the next slide are all the other agencies in public safety. Please notice the scale difference. The DAs are not the same, do not get the same amount of money as the Department of Corrections, even though they may have very well want to. On the DAs, the note is that the state does have a budget of a little over $10 million for them, but that really only roughly estimates about 10% of the total DA budgets in the DA offices across the state. As you can see there, you have a number of other agencies here. They're rather small. The two smallest ones are just between $100,000 and $200,000 in size. In comparison to what you heard from the human service analysts, where over 80% of their budgets were caught up in special payments to individuals, counties, nonprofits, and various providers, there's a significant difference here in the public safety program area. Here, it's really personal services that drive a lot of the spending. You have judicial staff, you have correction staff, you have troopers on the road, and they make up the bulk of the spending in terms of the spending in this area. Services and supplies represents about 22%. A lot of this is in the operation of 24-hour, 7-day-per-week institutions, in the youth authority, in corrections, where you have significant utility costs, food costs for inmates, clients, and offenders. And then you also have relatively high fuel costs for troopers and those kinds of folks. Those are the types of things that make up the services and supplies that might differ from other program areas. Capital outlay represents 4%. Much of that is, again, for the Owen project. Special payments is only 14% for this program area compared to the over 80% in human services. Much of that, about $233 million of the special payments there, are community corrections dollars. Military department has a large share with the transfer of Homeland Security to them, of the federal Homeland Security dollars that flow into the state. 80% of it then flow as a pass-through to local governments under federal requirements. A lot of that goes on as special payments. And again, OYA has approximately $100 million in special payments to both providers and county juvenile departments. Debt service totals $163 million in the governor's budget, or 4%, and about 133%, or the bulk of that, is for the Department of Corrections, who continue to need to build prisons over time. That is a significant increase of almost or over $30 million from the previous or the current 05-07 biennium. And then capital construction, which totals $611 million. Like I said, the majority of that is O-RIN, but there's also capital construction dollars in for deferred maintenance in OYA and corrections, as well as capital construction dollars in the military department. I apologize for the next slide. It looks better on the screen than it does on your sheets of paper in front of you, and that's just, I stole this from another presentation, and it didn't transfer too well between the PowerPoint presentations. But if you take a look at the screen, what we're trying to show here is the interrelationships of the various components of the public safety area and their local partners and other state partners, and the importance of that interrelationship or interconnectedness of the system. Community safety and law enforcement, these would be local law enforcement agencies, state and federal law enforcement agencies, as well as jails. The court process, judicial department, the DAs in the 36 counties, as well as the services provided by or funded by the Public Defense Services Commission, corrections, this is generally corrections department, and Oregon Youth Authority, but also includes county participation in terms of jails and post-prison parole and probation supervision activities. And finally, even though sometimes this is left out in the public safety arena, the prevention and intervention is very important in this area. I think Sheila had showed you in the previous presentation a prevention intervention chart and how it sort of funnels down and becomes more expensive per client. That actually was taken from a presentation that we will do Monday and Tuesday jointly with the Judiciary Committee. That was a public safety related presentation, and a lot of what public safety depends on for that intervention and prevention comes from the Department of Human Services in terms of funding and services and the partnerships that they have with the local government and nonprofits in the community. So again, please think of public safety as a system, not as Department of Corrections or just the courts. It really is a system. We haven't figured out a good analogy, whether it's a three-legged stool or some kind of balloon, or someone last week was talking about maybe we should just start singing that song that says that the hip bone's connected to the knee bone and the ankle bone and that.
Stand up and sing.
No. The next chart, I will not go through this, is just a list of some of the local partners or the linkages that have that public safety state agencies have with local, federal, and state and private entities. In terms of the budget drivers for this program area, I've built some graphics on these, and I apologize for, it does come up here on the handouts. I think we cut out the bottom of the demand for crime labs services at the bottom, but these are the major budget drivers: demographic changes, population growth, unemployment rate, and the number of persons in high crime risk categories are sort of the generic budget drivers, as they are for many state government services. More specifically to public safety are the statutory and ballot measure changes in criminal and juvenile laws. Best example, or most notable example, is ballot measure 11. I'll show you a graph in a couple minutes regarding that. There are numerous state and federal mandates, some of which are constitutional. A couple examples there are a federal mandate called the Prison Rape Elimination Act, or PREA, which is now in effect, affecting Department of Corrections as well as local jails. It places a significant number of new rules and regulations and practices on the correctional system, the local jail system. As an example of another, really a federal constitutional issue, are those around the corrections area, making sure that there's adequate health care and that prisons aren't too crowded. That has not been a problem in this state, but as an example, if you look to the south in California, their prison health care system is now under the supervision of a federal judge, and increasing costs significantly. And the federal courts are taking a look at capping the number of inmates in the California system because of overcrowding in prisons. And a lot of that is based on the federal constitution. So you have to keep those kinds of things even in mind with the correctional system and public safety. Of course, drug and illegal businesses, including gang activities, and probably the best example here is the meth crisis, both in terms of treatment of offenders and the pressure that puts on the courts and things. But one of the major drivers of property crimes are folks that are that are addicted to meth but are committing those crimes to pay for their habit. Crime rates, which I'll show you in a minute, for the state are major drivers, as well as demand for criminal crime lab services. Other drivers, quickly, caseload, staffing levels for district attorneys, courts, public defenders, and law enforcement agencies. And along with that, much in with funding levels on the local level for law enforcement, jails, and the such are also important cost drivers for state agencies. State labor force costs, health care costs for state employees are really probably the largest driver overall for these, as they are in other parts of state government. Excuse me. And then there are other costs in state agencies under this program area that drive, and I'm talking here about utilities, food costs, medical costs for purchase services for inmates and OYA. This is the cost of running 24-hour institutions. In the military area, the demand for National Guard services in the state, for call-outs for fire and other search and rescue, do drive state costs some too. And finally, growth in prison population, those under supervision by the county parole and probation offices and the two offices in those counties, two counties that are run by the state. And I'll come back to that in a minute. The crime rates, this is just showing, in this one, Oregon's property crime rate has fallen overall since 1980, but is above the national average. In terms of property crimes, it's interesting to note that the highest property crime rates by state are found in the western areas of the state. Washington has the highest, followed by Oregon, then Arizona, and then Hawaii. All those states, at least Washington, Oregon, and Hawaii, I'm not sure about Arizona, have significant meth problems, and that's probably what's driving, in part, these property crime rates. But generally, we've been higher than the lower, or the total U.S. crime rate. For violent crimes, the opposite holds true. It has been falling since 1980, but Oregon's rate is significantly lower than the U.S. total. It's in 2005, Oregon's rate was 2.9 per 1,000 population, ranked 34th in the country. If you take a look at some of the high crime areas, that crime rate in Washington, D.C., for example, is 14.1 per 1,000 population compared to 2.9. And the U.S. average was 4.7. And sort of since the most violent crime, if you can call it that, is the murder, and the murder rate in 2005 was roughly one-half of the national rate. So property crime rates are high in Oregon, while violent crime rates are lower than the national average. Those most at risk of committing crimes are males aged 15 to 39, and you'll see here that that group continues to grow in number. I must note on the first two bars on this sheet, 1980 and the 1990 are in different color just because I haven't put the years in between. But as you can see from the year 2000, there's been a slight increase generally continuing all the way through. But interesting, even though there's an increasing number, the proportion of the folks in this age group as a proportion of the total population actually has fallen some. In 1990, it was about 18% of the pop, or in 1990, it was about 19% of the population, and starting in year 2000, it's held pretty even at about 18% of the population. As I said before, growth in inmate population is the largest direct budget driver for this program area, and in, most notably in Department of Corrections. And you can also see that internally of that ballot measure 11 explains a large share of that growth. Must say that over the past few years, the forecasts have started to lower a bit as we get better history and better numbers and less crime being committed in terms of at least those sentences and the length of sentences for corrections. It still is increasing dramatically, though. Just to give perspective here, the midnight population last night in the Department of Corrections was 13,318. About 7.5% of those are women, and 92.5% are men. Even though the women make up a small share of that, that's where a lot of unexpected growth has been the last couple of years, mainly from property crimes. And so, therefore, Department of Corrections has had to add to the Coffee Creek facility in Wilsonville, which is the primary women's prison, much quicker than they thought they were going to have to. Keep in mind in the ballot measure 11, those folks were always in prison before. It's really what's driving it here is the increase in the length of their sentences, and that's what you see there in the light blue, is the impact of ballot measure 11. And the Public Safety Committee will get more into the direct and indirect impact of ballot measure 11 in those discussions. The other large contributor here in recent years is the repeat property offenders, or repo. Those are relatively new changes in that law, and you can see the impact there on the corrections budget. The other major sort of growth driver, at least in the Department of Corrections, is community corrections. It's growing slower than the prison population, but still, even over that time period from 06 to 2016, it's growing at about 1.5% per year. In comparison to the 13.5% growth over the time period in front of you on the graph for community corrections, the prison population has grown about 22%. Community corrections, you'll see a large increase in the governor's budget because they've rebased in the governor's budget the expenditures that are that the formula is based on, and we'll get into a lot more detail on that when we get to the Department of Corrections budget and the Public Safety Committee. Funding history, just to show you that for a couple of purposes, to give you the history in this budget, but also to quickly show you the impact that capital construction and prison construction and other projects have on the budget. So if you take a look at biennial like 1995 to 97, 2001-03, those are biennium where there were large increases in capital construction for prison construction. For example, the new prison in Madras and Deer Creek and much of the women's prison construction was authorized by the legislature in 2001-03, and that's why you see a larger share in that biennium. And sort of companion to that, if you take a look at the governor's budget in 07-09, you see a very large increase in the other budget. That really is the capital construction budget. Most of that is for the Owen project again. Key public safety issues for this, some are budget, some are not budget, are caseload or capacity issues in a number of agencies that are relatively new or not expected as much as it might be in the corrections budget. You have DOJ has significant increases for the defense of criminal convictions. PDSC has caseload increases as well as taking a look at the compensation that's paid to their contractors. DAs, I'm sure, will be visiting you about their issues in terms of their funding needs for staffing. Judicial Department has increases in their budget, as partially because of more cases, but just general increases in their budget in that area. I'm sure they'll be visiting you. OYA, in the past few biennia, starting in 2001-03, some of the institutions were closed. I believe the governor's budget opened some of those beds again, so you'll see that in the budget. And finally, for the CASA program under the Commission for Children and Families, there's some increases in that budget, partially because that CASA program is only serving about 30% of the kids that are eligible to be served under that program. Another public safety issue is making sure there's adequate funding for local partners, in this case community corrections staffing, and then also local jail funding, which is also part of the community corrections program. But another part of the local jail issue is purely a local issue, based on the availability of local funding. Some counties have need for jail beds, physical jail beds. Other counties have the jail beds in place but do not have the funding to operate those beds or open the beds. The best example, of course, is the one that's in the news the most, which is the Wapato prison in Multnomah County. Another key public issue is access to drug, alcohol, and mental health treatment programs. There's some additional funding in the governor's budget for this, but not enough to keep up with the pace of growth and demand in this area. Improving juvenile dependency system operations, including legal representation for human service caseworkers, child welfare caseworkers by DOJ attorneys. You'll see companion packages in DHS, Human Services, and DOJ for this. And there are other operation improvements that are in the governor's budget in this area, which is primarily human resource or human service related. Second from last slide, again, I'm sure you've heard enough about adequate number of state police troopers as a key issue this biennium. Just keep in mind that the number of state troopers has dropped roughly in half since about 1980. And the governor's budget does increase that by 139, but not with general fund, with a new revenue source, which is an insurance assessment increase. Compensation for judges, public defense service providers, and district attorneys will be an issue for you to discuss. The availability of resources to keep children with their families instead of in foster care and the child dependency, even though this is much of a human service issue, it also comes in as a public safety issue also in the child or juvenile dependency arena. Resources to address the manufacture, use of meth, including treatment, monitoring sales of precursor chemicals, and investigation and prosecution. This was started with a set of bills last year, the meth package, that's continued in the governor's budget. And, for example, you'll see continuation, really an increase in at least the dollars for this biennium over the amount available for last biennium in the drug court areas, in the Criminal Justice Commission, in their drug court grant program. And then secure and sufficient courthouse facilities. I believe the governor's budget, mainly the Chief Justice's budget, has that included in their budget. And I should note here, just so folks understand, I'm not an expert in this area, Robin is, but the governor's budget doesn't totally reflect what the Chief Justice's budget is. The governor's budget reduces the judicial branch as well as the legislative branch budget if it's higher than what the growth in the overall general fund budget for the rest of the executive branch or all of the executive branch is. So you will be hearing most likely from the judicial branch folks that this doesn't represent their true need, but the Chief Justice's budget does. Other major issues here are deferred maintenance and needs in those 24-hour facilities.
Mr. Wilson, I'm not sure we need to read the information that the members had in front
of them. And then I will close. The rest are there for your reading pleasure. You know, the last one I have in reference is the staff assignments between divisions.
Great. Thank you. Questions?
Representative Nathanson?
Questions about a couple of the graphs that we've been presented on page 7, for example, which shows the property crime rate has fallen overall, but still above the national rate. I'm skeptical of some information based on if this is strictly on reported crime. Do we know whether the amount of unreported crime has also commensurately decreased, or is that increasing?
I would have to check on that, Madam Chair, Representative Nathanson. I do note that in the past, I may have these numbers slightly off, only about one-third of the crimes are reported in some of these statistics.
I do appreciate seeing graphical data. In some cases, I'm a little concerned that it paints an even nicer picture, however, than the true case. For example, also on page 9, there's a graph that shows community corrections caseloads are growing at a slower rate than the prison population. But should those, is that good news or bad news? Should we see, are we seeing a situation where there are people who we should be helping who we're not, but we can't? Good question.
Madam Chair, Representative Nathanson, in terms of this is the forecast of the amount of folks that should be being supervised, there is a group that are, this does not include, for example, the misdemeanor caseload. This is the felony caseload. The state pays for the felony supervision. Counties are responsible for the misdemeanor responsibility, and that is not shown in this graph.
Thank you.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Wilson, we direct your attention to page 9, the public safety spending graph. I'm curious if I can receive a similar graph for the Department of Corrections. I understand the changes in the legislative approved budget, and at least in the last biennium, versus the EBL and governor's recommended budget.
I will prepare something.
Okay,
that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Has LFO attempted to quantify the impact of human services cuts and the residual domino effect on public safety budgets?
We have not, Madam Chair, Representative Kozak, we have not formally done that. It does have an impact on both, probably in terms of increases in the amount of crime in some areas, but also those decreases affected some of the funding sources for the community programs that the program area depends on in terms of funding, treatment, and intervention activities.
I think that would be helpful. I know that's a difficult thing to quantify, but... Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wilson, you referred to the criminal justice system as a system, and I think that's true, but we should keep in mind that systems are not always efficient. It has some similarities to the healthcare system. It's not particularly efficient, and fails to make investments in the early stages and pays for it dearly later, which is kind of similar to the healthcare system. But you failed to mention one area which is commonly of controversy, and I don't know if it will be a controversy this time, and that is community corrections spending in terms of our relationship to counties. And I just wanted to see if you'd maybe briefly comment on that.
Madam Chair, Senator Gelfand, there is a sizable increase in the governor's budget from about 193 to about $239 million for community corrections, and much of that is based on rebasing the expenditures that the formula is based on. I think I mentioned that. As far as I know, the counties and the sheriffs are satisfied with that from all that I've heard, whether you'll hear more or not. You should not hear as much as you have in previous years because of that rebasing.
Representative Shields.
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. First of all, a comment. I wanted to
you know, when you're taking a look at the statistics on decreasing crime, there is some controversy over what was really driving that decrease in crime from the 90s on, so I just wanted to make that clear. And then two, Dan, I was hoping you could comment about, you know, when we build a prison from start to finish, we end up going out to borrow using COPs that often are quite expensive. Do you have any sense of how much it costs to actually pay off a prison from start to finish?
Madam Chair, Representative Shields, I would have to get the exact number, but in terms, I remember looking at this about a couple of years ago, that in terms of the cost of the prison, just to build it, is roughly half, when I use the term roughly, very underlying, underscoring, of what you end up paying for over time in terms of debt service and the cost of building that prison. So you do pay a significant amount in debts, in interest on that debt service, and it roughly doubles the cost of it.
Representative?
Follow up. So with Madras, do you remember what the cost was of that prison?
Well, the Madras, Madam Chair, Representative Shields, was roughly $190 million to construct, or will be by the time it's fully constructed.
So that would be double over time. Double over time.
Roughly. I'd have to verify those numbers.
Representative Boone?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate all the information, but I especially appreciated the continuum of with the primary prevention at the first and the cheapest and the best use of our dollars to probably try to get that number down in the long run on the cost of prisons and the number of people going into the correction system. And I would hope that in our deliberations we will continue to give primary prevention the attention it needs, and because it is really a good use of our dollars in the long run.
Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you, Mr. Wilson, and the other LFO analysts as well. We appreciate it. We are not quite on time, but we're not doing bad. Ms. Jordan, and who else do we have? Oh, Mr. Whalen. Oh, and Ms. Lamont,
yeah.
You are joining us.
Yeah, they drug me.
Thank you.
They forced me.
Are you kicking off?
I am.
Ms. Jordan.
Okay. It's best last.
Yes, indeed.
Our presentation is for all of the program areas, which consists of five programs that encompasses 53 agencies in the state, and also represent 39% of the total state budget, but only 5% of general fund. In the program area, we have the administration programs, which include statewide elected officials, commissions, state agencies. There are 12 in total that provide direction, policy direction, and core central services to agencies. This slide just shows you the magnitude of their budgets, and I'm not going to go over the numbers to try to keep it real brief. Consumer and business service area includes 17 agencies that work to protect consumers and workers and promote a positive business climate in the state. Your economic development area includes four agencies, OECD's Oregon Economic and Community Development, Employment, Housing, and Veterans Affairs, to aid businesses, communities, and people in providing economic and cultural enhancement throughout the state. The legislative branch includes five supporting agencies and the Commission on Indian Services. Natural Resources includes 14 agencies to manage organic natural resources. Resource protection are agencies that provide a variety of services, including pollution, land use and water use control, consumer protection, and natural resource produce promotion. And then transportation includes the Department of Transportation and Aviation. Dallas is going to talk about the next three slides, and then I will talk about natural resources and transportation. Robin's going to do the economic development and consumer business, and then Dallas will wrap us up with the administration programs.
All right.
Madam Chair, members,
I'm Dallas Wyman, Legislative Fiscal Office. The next slide you see shows the growth in overall expenditures in this group of programs. Looks like a sizable run-up, but if you look at the numbers from 0305 to the 0709 central budget level, it's about $2.4 billion. $1.1 billion of that are out of the PERS Trust Fund. That increase for payments to beneficiaries, recipients, a sizable run-up because of the run to the exits, if you will, of people in state and government service retiring after the 03 reform legislation. Another half a billion of that increases the OTA, principally roads and bridges. And then the rest of there are loan programs in here and a number of other things. It's quite a quick read, but the significant drivers are causing the increase for those two program areas. As you can see, the predominant source of funds here are other funds. These areas, the eight sizable other funds, so $6.3 billion of that is for PERS payments to beneficiaries, retirees, and reimbursements. Another $1.4 billion of that number is out of unemployment comp insurance payments. We have a lot of loan programs in here, which are other funded, self-sustaining. Also regulatory, which are entirely self-sustaining, UCPS and the like. You will see these agencies in I believe, four different subcommittees: administration, natural resources, transportation, economic, and development. Well, maybe all five, maybe five of the six. Anything but human services. No, I take it back. There will be a human services team. So you will see some of these programs in each and every one of your subcommittees, I believe. The next one just shows you where the growth is. Most of it, again, is in other funds. The general fund is a very small portion of it. Lottery fund and federal funds are also small players. But the other funds, again, the increase here is mostly 56% of it is due to increasing in PERS benefits, the payment out of the trust fund. These are not payments directly from state agencies to people, but payments out of the trust fund for benefits. And the balance, or another part, a big chunk of that increase is, again, the road and bridge program in Department of Transportation.
Okay, the next slide, we're going to talk about the budget issues for natural resources and transportation. In the natural resources area, there was a pent-up demand to resume services that were curtailed during the recession, so the reduction of agency services over the past three biennia will be reflected in policy packages in the governor's budget. Also, as a way to manage our ability to continue some of the services, we used Federal Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Fund to replace general funds that will be replaced. We will no longer be able to use those federal funds, and so the general fund will be picking up those services in this governor's budget. There are a number of fees, supported programs, and there will be some places where fees will be increased, requests for increasing fees in a number of those budgets in natural resources. And then the growth of lottery funds in parks and natural resource area provides some opportunities. The governor is proposing several initiatives that would utilize those parks and natural resource lottery funds. That is a place where the legislature may weigh in on whether that's where you want those monies to go. Transportation program, there's the issue for passenger rail comes up every session, a lack of dedicated sources. Highway trust funds cannot be used to operate the passenger rail. The Department of Transportation is forwarding an initiative to the legislature to utilize the specialty plate license revenues that people pay fees on specialty plates. Those are the vanity plates, commonly used as vanity plates, which now is dedicated to the litter patrol. They are suggesting that that money be redirected to use it for the passenger rail program. and the highway trust funds then be used for litter patrol. The issue, policy issue for the legislature to consider there is whether those programs, the amount of money that that program for litter patrol is going to displace other programs, projects or delay projects for transportation. Implementation of Federal ID Act and Senate Bill 640 has to do with issuance of driver's license. And if the legislature decides to adopt the federal regulations, there will be significant increases in costs to implement the Federal Real ID Act. Senate Bill 640, the legislature adopted last session, is into implementation now, which has to do with biofacial recognition when they take your picture for your driver's license, so they can match you up in the system. Capital construction of ODOT facilities and debt service roll-up costs from 0507 as considerable in the lottery funds that we use for the infrastructures.
In the economic development and consumer and business services area, the issues primarily relate to policy packages that are in the governor's budget and decisions that the legislature is going to want to make about the level of funding that they want in terms of infrastructure bond programs, the debt service roll-up associated with those bonds, and some new initiatives in the governor's budget, expansion of the innovation economy effort, the workforce development project to address needs within the system, and then also the issue in employment, which is that employment reflects the economy, and it's a good thing, but there is declining workload and revenues in the employment department as a result of that. And then in consumer and business services, the department has an initiative that would provide for e-permitting on building permits statewide, which is a long-term initiative which the legislature is going to want to look at.
And lastly, administration basically supports the rest of government operations, and what drives it is really the size and operation of all other government units, with the exception maybe Department of Revenue, which is its budget is driven somewhat by just the size of the population in Oregon and the number of taxpayers. So it's kind of inflationary. It just kind of tracks inflation and population. There are, however, in this session, some things you'll have to be considering. They're being presented. One of them is a proposed education, employment, health care benefits plan or project, which would take care of, much like all other public employees, it would take care of school districts. This would be housed in the Department of Administrative Services. You've heard about OGEN, the new computer thing for judiciary, as well as OWEN. Also, there's proposed a new statewide GIS or geophysical information system. Total price tag on this is roughly $180 million, $30 million of which over time would be general fund. There's whether or not the policy decision you'll have to make is whether or not you want to undertake that in 0709 biennium. Government employees retirement, there are about 30,000 people out there in public service that are eligible to be retired. This affects the PERS as well as within state. Then, if we have a lot of retirees, the demand on an administration to recruit and train and retain their employees. With respect to taxes, there's a sunset on an existing use of tobacco and other taxes to fund what's been favorably viewed upon a tobacco task force compliance group. That sunset date is December 31 of this year. There's a bill to extend that, lacking that extension of that sunset date, that task force would cease to operate. And then there's also the cost of collecting new taxes. As you're probably aware, the governor's budget proposes a new corporate minimum tax as well as a new cigarette tax, both of which would have some cost of implementation within the Department of Revenue. With that pretty much wraps up what we have. We'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
just enough to whet our appetite for more. Questions? Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just wanted to get this on the record. You already mentioned the issue with Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Fund and how we're not able to use that. There's also a movement of more Measure 66 funds back to OWEB in the governor's budget. And I've been told by, I think, LFO staff, including you, that there's some limitation on us being able to move those back to other departments in terms of what their use is, and that's actually resulted in another general fund backfill in some of those departments for existing services, not expansions in many cases. Would that be a correct statement? Or?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, the use of Measure 66 funds is driven by Constitution, and use of those funds is restricted in some cases. Yes.
Yeah, more restricted now.
We'll get to pay attention to that in the subcommittee. Any other questions? Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. What's the estimated cost of the Federal Real ID Act and Senate Bill 640?
Madam Chair, Senator Edwards, I believe that the agency is proposing a $3.5 million to $4 million policy option package just to implement those two items.
Representative Beyer, did you have a question?
It's not so much a question. It was just, it's been my understanding, Madam Chair, that number is lower than what I've been told their estimate is, significantly lower, so I'm not sure what our differences are.
Thank you. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. Could you address what negative effect on the governor's proposed budget that the demise of the Rural Schools and Communities Act might have on the state level?
Yeah, you're right.
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I don't believe that there's a negative effect on at the state level state budgets because the money goes directly to the counties for county programs and activities. If we had to backfill those revenues, then it would have an effect on state.
Follow-up, please.
Senator.
It's my understanding that a significant portion of that money goes into the education formula, and so I believe it would have a negative effect.
Madam Chair, I'm not the right person, analyst for education, to answer that question, so I would have to defer.
Madam Co-Chair, $31.8 million.
Senator Devlin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. $31.8 million increase in the EBL because of the lack of those funds. $31.8 million increase in the essential budget level because of the lack of those funds.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you for your attention. Thank you to all the people who presented. This was really useful information. And LFO has provided us with yet more fascinating, riveting information, in fact. They've prepared detailed analysis of the governor's recommended budget, a summary document, which everyone should make their way through, and then detailed analyses of all the agencies. You may pick your copies up on the way out. And they've also, at my request, provided additional labels for your orientation notebook so that you can find it on the shelves when you want to refer to it throughout the session. We're adjourned.